Well, hello there, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 214. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, James Jones.
Hello.
And Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
So happy to have these guys with me this week. Unfortunately, John, still out, as we explained last week. It's going to be a couple more weeks. It's going to be a three-man show this time. I am working on a special guest, someone we've never had before, but I kind of don't want to say anything in case it falls through. So, anyway, well, I'll try to have somebody in the fourth chair next week, but who it will be remains to be seen. Let's put it that way.
It'll just be me with a slightly different voice. It'll be fun.
Yes, yeah. James is going to pull double duty.
James Sunset Beat style evil twin.
Yes. Well, one will be called James, the other will be called Jones. So, anyway, let's kick off with new business, Greg.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to mention something. Some news came out today about if people aren't aware of the whole like Super Mario anniversary thing. It was 25 years in September of Super Mario Brothers coming out in Japan for the Famicom, and they've kicked off with all this stuff, and they've got like two DSIs that are Mario-themed, and now a Japanese Wii that's Mario-themed, but so the centerpiece is the Mario All-Stars re-release.
Yes.
Which they're doing in Japan with the CD.
On a disc.
On a disc. This is what I'm kind of coming to with this. You got like CD and like an art book and like development materials or whatever in there. Goodness knows how insightful or interesting they are. But today it came out that they were going to do the same thing for Europe. It is coming out on the same day as DKC Returns.
But everything that comes out in Japan comes out in Europe this generation.
These days, yeah, this is a pattern we've identified, is that, you know, Europe is
slightly less discerning, might be the word.
The lapdog sort of wagging its tail and looking longingly at
see,
its master.
I don't see Reggie bringing a $30 ROM on disc to America. I don't think that flies here.
Yeah, I kind of intuitively feel similarly, yeah.
Is it Super Mario All-Stars, or is it Super Mario All-Stars shitty PAL version?
This is the question, ooh, exactly, yeah. Because if it is a VC game on a disc, effectively, as we've covered in the previous episodes, PAL VC games have issues being sort of faithful to the original PAL versions.
Faithful is the right word, yes.
In which case, what it means is no progressive scan and 50 hertz. Now, Super Nintendo games are not that bad, because they tend to have the borders fixed, some of them have the speed fixed, the sound is never affected because it had a separate processor for that.
Greg, can you we've talked about a lot of these elements of PAL conversions before, but the borders is something I don't understand. Is that, or is that a different resolution?
It is. There's obviously, we're in the age of high def now. Well, Nintendo isn't, but, you know, that's the world. But America had a standard with 480, 480 lines,
right.
And the PAL regions had a standard of 576.
Yep.
So what would happen is that when you had these kind of sloppy conversions of NTSC games, they just sort of filled out the amount of lines that there were. 480 lines out of 576, effectively. And so this created these just black borders on the top and bottom. You know, certain games would move to correct this by stretching it out, upscaling it or whatever, but a lot of them didn't. So that's why you have the border issue. And that's what would be really sort of offensive about this
it's $30 and broken.
Of a VC game on a disc, if it literally didn't even give you the option to run it in progressive scan, like the Wii games these days, you know, almost all have that option.
God, that'll be amazing.
With a few egregious exceptions.
That would be trolling, right? If they were just released
it
that.
It would be. I think I would be tempted, if this happened, to seek out Laurent Geeks and Otaku Fisher, who runs Nintendo of Europe, and sort of put on a leather glove and then immediately take it off so I could slap him with it.
How do you request a press comment that involves slapping someone with leather glove?
Look, if you could get a shoe thrown at the president, I think it's possible.
There you go.
So anyway, what you just wanted to say, that this is coming to Europe and that you're worried about
it's
it.
It's coming to Europe, and you're on notice, Nintendo of Europe.
Okay.
It's 50 hertz on a disc. There will be consequences of some kind. I'm not sure what they will be yet. Maybe they'll involve leather gloves.
Would that officially cement Nintendo of Europe as, like, the fuck-up division if they release that game in 50 years?
I think that's already on the books.
That's the interesting about 3DS Virtual Console, of course, because it doesn't involve television standards. I'm kind of seeing if there's any possible fashion in which they can sodomize it. I'm hopeful they won't.
R&D's working on it. Don't worry. So, well, it's sort of a corollary to that. Greg was talking about the Mario 25th anniversary themed Wii. And from what I could gather reading in Japanese on a cell phone, which is like really crippling my ability to understand what's going on, There is a version of the original Super Mario Brothers game that comes bundled on the console.
Preloaded, yeah.
Yes, where they've replaced all the question mark blocks with 25.
That's right, a ROM hack for the 25th
anniversary. Yeah, if that's the only change, I just...
Well, it's red.
I really question the sanity of anyone who gets excited about a ROM hack where the coin blocks now have the number 25 on it.
It's just funny.
It's really weird.
I think it comes bundled with a red Wii Remote Plus as well.
Oh, because it's just so not Nintendo. I mean, that's not something they would do.
I mean, the idea of a red console is pretty cool. It's pretty damn late in the cycle for that kind of thing
right now.
It was
promised to us in 2005, as well as Lime Green.
Yes, I've seen one before at E3.
We're never getting a Lime Green Wii.
I don't know. I mean, the other weird thing about Wii is, you know, when it's tied so much to these digital downloads. I mean, in this case, the new Red Wii actually has a digital download already on it, pre-installed when you buy it. And yet, of course, you can't transfer your purchases from one console to another, which for me is a pretty major discouragement to buying a new console. Because, you know, I could sell my old one, but I can't get all that stuff back, and I've got hundreds of dollars of stuff, so...
Yeah, I don't really see a reason why you would buy another Wii, even if it is the awesome 25th anniversary edition.
I could buy a new Wii to replace my old one. I would, and you know, people did that with GameCube too when they released new colors or they traded up to the Q or something.
I got a black GameCube. I was set for life.
Yeah, me too. But there are people who like to do that, but I think Nintendo's actually making it less desirable this generation because of their crappy-ass digital content management.
Dude is just chilling on a shelf right now.
Well, anyway, Greg, on to games you've actually been playing.
Yep, so on the glorious 480p-enabled land of Japanese virtual console, I've been enjoying the latest release. Two games came out in the same week. It's quite rare these days.
It is the apocalypse. Mm.
One of them was Fazanadu, which is an interesting game from back in 1987. Weird sort of genealogy to this, finding out about it. So it comes from Falcom's Dragon Slayer series, the second game of which was called Xanadu, and then Hudson licensed that name and made a Famicom game, hence Fazanadu, and then it got picked up by Nintendo in the Western markets, the America and Europe. So it was kind of a Nintendo game, and I think even showed up on Captain N in some capacity.
Wow,
that wasn't just...
That makes me really hopeful that Nintendo might actually bring this to the West, because if they published it originally, they should still have the rights to it. And, you know, it was in English. I played this. When I was a kid, we called it Faxanadu. You know, we didn't know any better. It's been a long time since I touched this game, but my memory of it as a child is extremely positive. I thought it was awesome. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, and I'm kind of drooling right now over the idea that I might get to play this again, because it's a very, very rare NES game, and it's never been re-released at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's cool to see it get a re-release now. It has been rated, I think, by Australia, which is usually
a good
bellwether
sign
for it.
Yeah.
Nintendo published it in Europe and America, as I said. So, yeah, it's very likely that this is coming to America. I have no familiarity with it at all, directly. So this is my first time with it. I heard it was very similar to Zelda 2, which I got on with pretty well.
But in a giant tree.
Yes, it is in a giant tree. Yeah. And the colour scheme of the game is correspondingly brown.
ominous.
It is. I haven't played Gears of War. I confidently say it's the brownest game I've ever played. It is bits of green in there as well, and even some brownie greens.
But, and it also, Fasanadu also has a reputation for having excellent music.
I like the music so far. Okay. I mean, it's what you kind of expect from an 8-bit game in a lot of ways, in terms of you're going to hear certain bits of it quite a lot, but it's not grating or anything. I've got along with it pretty damn well so far, but it was funny coming into it with the sort of expectation that, you know, it's very similar to Zelda 2, because, you know, there's certain things about Zelda 2 when I played it with Retroactive that were a bit irritating. You know, I enjoyed it, obviously, otherwise I probably wouldn't be picking this up now, but I was like, oh god, I hope it's better in these regards. And imagine my horror when I've got to the point where you have to, like, you start off the game and you haven't got anything, basically, and then after a little bit you get some money and you start buying your equipment, and you get this little dagger. And this dagger is so pathetic. It's even shorter, I think, than Link's crappy little sword in Zelda 2.
That doesn't surprise me, given, I mean, if you look at the Ease series, which is also Falcom, the same developer, in the Ease games, you always have these ridiculously short swords that you have to ram into the enemies with. I mean, they're played mostly from a different perspective other than Ease 3, but...
Yeah, because this is like Zelda 2. It's side perspective, although it isn't side scrolling. There is no scrolling. It's a screen-by-screen game, sort of like, you know, MSX Vampire Killer would have been, you know, the kind of precursor to Castlevania.
Or the original Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, but that's top-down.
Sure.
So you get this little dagger, but it's worse than even the range, because some of the first enemies you come across are these little sort of spiky things that come up about knee-high, and of course you go to crouch and kill them, and you can't. There is no crouch. So it's like, wait a minute, I've got one weapon which is rubbish and it can't even kill the lowliest enemy in the game. It was a bad start. I was like, oh god, what have I run into? And then the next sort of nasty surprise was the way the experience system works. So similar to Zelda 2, sort of action RPG element, and yet as you beat enemies you gain experience, but you don't just automatically level up. What happens is there's no lives like Zelda 2. There's no sort of game over screen.
Oh, that's good. That was messy in Zelda 2.
Yeah, I mean, I approve of that, certainly. But what does happen is it'll tell you what your next sort of level you can sort of reach is, so how many experience points you need. But you don't just gain it immediately upon reaching that level. You have to sort of cash in your points at a church. And then it gives you a sort of new title and it saves the game, or gives you a password. I think there's a difference there between the Japanese and the Western version, but I'm just using the save state.
Yeah.
You know, the suspend feature anyway. So the point is that you could, if you've gone into one of these sections, which is the dungeon-y kind of parts of the game, where you're quite far from a town, or whatever, you could have accrued a lot of experience, maybe significantly more than the threshold for the next level. And then if you can't quite get back there intact, then you might end up dying and basically not getting any credit for all of that work. So it's got some of that same sort of frustration there with Zelda 2. So definitely behooves you to stock up on your potions, and, you know, you probably end up playing pretty conservatively as a result. Certainly I have so far. But the one thing it does do that I quite like in terms of the grinding element, if you like, is that you don't so much have to grind for money to buy the kind of more basic supplies, like potions that you're going to want to keep around, or you also have to buy a lot of keys. Like, doors that you need to go through, you need to have a key to get through, which you just buy, but it's not a one-time thing. You know, if you want to go back to that place, you've got to buy the same key again from the locksmith in town.
So it's like the first Dragon Quest, Dragon Warrior.
Right, is it? Yeah, I guess a lot of these things are classical sort of RPG tropes that presumably apply to the Dragon Slayer series that were carried over.
So locksmithing games, essentially.
Yeah. So you've got to spend money on stuff like that, so you always need money. But what happens is as you go through the levels, if you do die or you restart the game using your save or password or whatever, you get an endowment of gold on the basis of how high a level you are. So once you get going, you'll have a decent amount of cash to just start off, and you say, okay, let's stock up on potions, get whatever keys I need, and you won't have to, like, go outside the town and beat a bunch of baddies just to get the money to pay for that. So that definitely helps kind of streamline the process quite a bit.
So are you enjoying it? I mean, obviously you were a little disturbed at first by the weapon. I assume the weapon enemy kind of thing balanced out a little as you went farther.
Yeah, definitely. Once you go a bit further, you start earning more money. You can buy a vastly superior sword, which is much more playable. It can even hurt the enemies that are a bit lower to the ground, and it's got better range, and you start upgrading your armor and stuff, and you can use magic as well. You've got like a basic projectile attack to start, but you can get different kinds of magic as it goes in. So yeah, it's a very classic kind of 8-bit thing, almost like the original Metroid. You know, we had these explorative games where you became more powerful. A lot of the sensation that they achieved with that is making you so painfully weak in the beginning.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's kind of a barrier to entry here. And yes, you have to deal with the issues of the grindingness. Like I said, that fact that your experience points are sort of always at risk, if you like. But yeah, I have now kind of, I've gotten into a kind of a rhythm with it, gotten into it. So I find it, I don't know, in some ways a little easier to play than Zelda 2. It's a little less odd in terms of the whole sort of, it hasn't got any kind of separation between an overworld map and then the battle scenes or anything like that. It's all one sort of relatively continuous world apart from the lack of scrolling.
I mean, the sort of the setting is this giant tree, right? And I guess the town is sort of down at the base of the trunk. And as you progress through the game, from my vague memories, I think you kind of get higher and higher in the tree, and sort of the goal is to get to the top of the canopy.
Yeah, you're restoring the sort of life to the tree. Like, one of the things I recently did, there's like a quest with three springs that you're kind of restoring. And it is cohesive in that way. You know, it's not like the usual kind of wacky kind of video game thing where it's like, oh, well, now here's a completely different place.
Here's the fire world, here's the sky world.
Which even Metroid, which was sort of relatively organic compared to a lot of video games of the time, does.
Yeah, you still take an elevator into this other part that's sort of themed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that is rare to have it set in a very cohesive place like that.
And the other thing is, in terms of when you restart, you don't have to worry about restarting at the same place the way you do in Zelda 2. You might lose your experience points, or whatever, you know, you kind of, you'll be angry that you're going back to the church and you haven't got credit for those experience points, but at least you're going back to the last church you were in.
Well, I'm really excited. For the second week in a row, I'm very jealous of you playing this Japanese game, but I'm pretty excited about this probably coming to the West, and if we can get Battle for Olympus, we'll have the trifecta of Zelda 2 and its progeny. So that's pretty exciting. It's good to hear that Virtual Console is not quite dead yet, and Fasanadu's certainly been one of the most highly requested games from the beginning, because it is pretty obscure but awesome, or at least people think it's awesome. People remember it being awesome. But it's quite hard to get these days.
Of course, I missed that. I'm missing out on the English script, but from everything I've read, it sounds like it is very Simon's Quest-y, you know, not always.
It could be worse than Zelda 2, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. That was part of it. I played Zelda 2 on the PAL Virtual Console when I had the option to buy it for the Japanese one. I really wish I'd just played it on the Japanese one, because the music wouldn't have been screwed up. And, you know, what would I have missed, really?
I am Error.
Would have had a relatively similar incidence of looking at game facts either way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a topic we'll come up to later in listener mail. But moving on, my main new business this week, I guess the one thing that I don't think I've talked about before, and I did play some this week, is Plants vs. Zombies. I got the Game of the Year edition on Steam for like $5, maybe 10. The reason I think it might be of interest to our listeners is that this game, did it just come out on DS, or is it coming out on DS? I don't know, but there is a DS version that's either out or it will be out within the next couple of months. Of course, PopCap has a reputation for tailoring their games to the platforms really well. I know that Peggle Dual Shot or Double Shot, whatever it was called, actually Q Entertainment made that version for DS, but it
That's
was
right, yeah.
meant to be very good, you know, as far as Peggle goes. And, you know, Peggle has this reputation for being sort of a super casual game. I mean, it's so simple, it's so easy. it's so gratifying to play, you know, it doesn't really ever oppose you very much. Plants vs. Zombies is much more of a gamer's game, I think. It's still casual in presentation, and it's still, the interface is really simple. It's certainly very accessible, but it's more difficult. Well, everything's more difficult than Peggle. But Plants vs. Zombies is, it's a strategy game, and you actually have to apply some strategy. I haven't had a whole lot of incidences of losing a mission, but there's certainly been a lot of missions that kind of I got close, or I just didn't feel like I did as well as I should have on it. The game can feel overwhelming at times. And if you haven't played it, basically the premise is that you are planting all these plants in a garden in your backyard. And they're all like mutant things. They shoot peas, or they produce sunlight, which is your energy. So it's basically a real-time strategy game in that sense. You're planting all these different units, and they have all these different properties. And the enemies are the zombies who are invading your backyard. For some reason, they're trying to get to the house, and the plants are your only line of defense. And the zombies, they come in on these rows. The number of rows increases as you get through the game, but they come on these rows. So some people describe this as tower defense. I would sort of argue that it's really not that, because tower defense always involves a lot of pathing. Either you create the path, or the path is predetermined, but basically these enemies are kind of, you know, they're coming in along a path, and you have to put towers on the side of that path to keep them from getting to the end. And in this case, the path is exactly the same every single mission. It's just straight. There's five or six rows, and the zombies are just coming straight from the right to the left, and they're trying to get to the other side. So you don't have to worry about the path. What you have to worry about is putting the right plants in the right rows, and actually, even more important, I would think, is before the mission, you have to select the right group of plants that will sort of take care of the job. And that's where Plants vs. Zombies becomes really interesting, because it does start out really slowly. I would actually recommend against playing the demo, because if you play the demo, you'll probably really like it, and then when you buy the game, you'll have to play through all that crap again, and that's the worst part of the game. It just starts out really slowly, because you start with basically like one kind of plant to do your dirty work. And the great thing about the game is that it never really seems to stop giving you new units or new enemies, and so these strategic choices of which ones do I carry into battle and which ones do I use for a given situation, they just get increasingly complex to the point where it's really almost overwhelming how many options you have at your disposal and how many different kinds of zombies can come in there and mess up your strategy because they circumvent certain kinds of plants or they're just very strong against certain things. It's impressively complex. I mean, I think I'm probably maybe two-thirds, three-fourths of the way through the game, and I've got 40 plants to choose from. I can only carry in like 7 or 8 into battle. So you really have to make some decisions up ahead of time. What am I going to take into this? What are my tools going to be? And then the zombies, there's a new plant and or a new zombie introduced basically every single level. And these levels usually only last 5 minutes.
Did you get like a certain amount of information on which to base your decisions,
yes,
sort of ex ante, or is it trial and error?
No, there's an almanac. So when you get a new plant, you can learn what it does. But with the zombies, they give you sort of a preview of what kinds of zombies are going to be attacking, but it's not, it may not include everything. And then also, right, they will launch a new zombie at you once before letting you sort of read a description of it to find out how to deal with it. So you always, there's always kind of this threat of a new kind of zombie coming in and you're not exactly sure how to deal with it, and you kind of have to think about it on the fly and figure out how you want to try to kill it. It's a very tense game. It's real time. So, you know, yeah, these zombies come in, and usually they come in one or two at a time, but there's always this point in the mission, and it's indicated on the meter at the bottom, but there's at least one point in the mission, if not two or three, where you'll have like a wave of zombies, a massive wave. And I mean, it'll throw, you know, 15 at a time at you, and you better have your defenses really built up or they will just chew right through it. And it's exciting. It's really well done. It's all very cute graphics. It runs on my netbook just fine, so it'll run on anything really. And I've heard the iPad version is excellent. It does seem like a kind of game that would work very well with that kind of finger pointing touchscreen control. I'm sure the DS version will be quite good as well. I'm a little curious to see how they handle the real estate, just because it is a left to right game, and you know the DS screens are fairly small, but you have two of them. So I'm wondering, how do they split this up, or do you hold it book style? I'm not sure exactly how they're going to deal with all that, but I'm sure they're going to do a good job with it, because they always have with their DS ports. So anyway, that's Plants vs. Zombies. No matter how you get it, it's really a pretty cheap game, and it's really good. Another one that I will touch on very briefly, because I've only played it for like 30 minutes, is Explosionade, which is the Xbox indie game that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago. It was just released today as of this recording, so it had been delayed for some interesting reasons related to the to the marketplace and the way Microsoft reports sales of indie games. It's kind of a larger topic that we won't get into right now. But anyway, it's finally out there. As with Shoot One Up, which is their Mommy's Best Games previous title on the same service, it costs $1. And my first impression of it is that it certainly should be easily worth your $1. It's probably worth a lot more than that. And of course, buying this game is it's part support, part promotion for Grapple Buggy, which is their next big title that is still being worked on.
And that's going to get published for XBLA, right? Rather than the marketplace.
That's the plan. It's still being shopped around, but yeah, that's the plan. So that's probably going to be sometime next year for Grapple Buggy. But Explosionade is out now, and I do like it. I don't know if I like it as much as their previous two games, just because it's more slow paced. So it looks and feels a lot like Metal Slug, you know, the arcade Contra style shooter thing. But you're always in the tank. So, and this tank, it's like a mech tank. It's like a vertical tank or whatever. But it walks around pretty slowly. It has a machine gun you can fire in all directions with a joystick, and it has an unlimited supply of grenades. Although you can only fire out one or two at a time. You have to wait a second for it to recharge. But you certainly are encouraged to use grenades quite a lot. And you have to arc them, you know, they have a certain sort of ballistic trajectory, so they're not the easiest thing to aim, so there's some skill involved there as well. And the pattern so far with Mommy's Best Games is that I boot up their titles, and it already sounds pretty interesting because of the basic premise, but within 5 minutes, I'm shocked to find that there's this whole other mechanic that they haven't even really advertised that makes the game feel totally bizarre and really, really interesting. Like in Shoot One Up, it was the fact that you can use your shields to kill enemies and get 10 times as many points. And if you actually try to do that, you end up playing the game completely differently, not even really as a shooter at all. And it's really, really fun, and it makes the game just totally feel different. In Weapon of Choice, it was the fact that not only do you have these characters with all these crazy weapons, and you're crawling around on the ceiling and on the walls and all that stuff, but also you have this death view, or what I forget exactly what they call it, but you only have one life. Basically, you get hit once, you're dead, and anytime a shot comes near you, time slows down, and you have that window to basically get the hell out of the way. And the game looks like Contra on the surface, Weapon of Choice, but you add that mechanic and it feels completely different. And it really changes the way you play the game. It's fascinating. There's always so much innovation packed into these games. And so with Explosionade, the really weird quirk that I had no idea was coming is that you have the shield, you can just push the L trigger, and it brings up the shield. It actually works kind of like Smash Brothers. You know, if you take enough hits on it, it wears out and you can't use it for a while. Or if you just hold it down for too long. But the weird thing about the shield is, if you're in midair and you turn on the shield, it will make you bounce off the ground and sling back up into the air, which is used for some really wild platforming challenges, and also can sort of help you move around faster than you could by walking or jumping alone. And again, I had no idea this was coming. I was like, whoa, this is a really weird little feature that they popped in here. So it seems like it's just full of really interesting mechanics. And the way the game is structured is kind of interesting, because it's kind of like Bangaio, in that it's all like one-room challenges. They're like puzzle rooms, basically. They're full of enemies, you know, and things to shoot. But the goal is to sort of to get to the end of the room and or kill all the enemies as fast as possible. And just the controls are complex enough, and the mechanics of shooting and jumping and bouncing around are all so weird that, you know, you kind of, it ends up being sort of like a puzzle just to get through the room. in a somewhat efficient manner. So it seems like a really interesting game. Again, it costs $1. So if you have an Xbox 360, you really should go check this out. And there's even even then there's a free trial. So you don't even have to commit your $1 until you've already played it.
Too risky.
But the animation is really great. It's full of the same kind of butt rock that that was in the previous games from this developer. So it seems like a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to playing more of it. And of course, I'm still really psyched about Grapple Buggy. So finally, I will give a I'll give just a flyby update on some of these damn RPGs I've been playing, because they keep coming up. I'm not going to talk about them, but I just wanted to kind of throw out the fact that I finally beat Mother 3. Finally. Oh my god, it was like 45 hours. It felt like when I was halfway through the game, I thought I was near the end. So it really felt like it just went on and on and on. It just never would finish. I'm finally done with it. The ending is certainly interesting, and I'm looking forward to recording that spoiler cast with Neil pretty soon. And we're finally going to read some of the forum comments that we weren't able to during Retroactive. I've also passed the 100-hour mark on Dragon Quest IX. I don't know if I should feel proud of that or just kind of scared, but that game is...
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, that game is a problem. I haven't beaten it yet. I mean, I feel like half that time has been spent just running around looking for alchemy shit, which is really sort of depressing.
Well, in the spirit of this little feature, I should say, I have beaten the final super boss in Chrono Trigger now.
Nice.
So, and ending number 30. I still think probably the two playthroughs together still only adds up to like 35 hours or something.
And most of that is obviously leveraged in the first playthrough.
Yeah, definitely. It's just Kids League stuff.
We'll get an update from John on his Chrono Trigger progress when he comes back.
Hold on. Let me do it. It's still wrapped. Guys, I'm going to get...
Well, you know, he is moving across the country. It's the perfect
now
time.
Now it's wrapped and packed in a box, actually. You're right.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he fought Gato or whatever in the Millennial Fair. I mean, yeah. I think he did take the wrapping off.
He's pretty far in then.
He's got to win him some 15 silver points, you know?
Yeah. Once you get to 50, you win the game, right?
You know, John has a very long car ride coming up, and maybe he will actually pick up...
Drive, and not play his DS.
Maybe he'll just play Chouniki on his PSP the whole way.
No, he won't, because he won't get out of Georgia before it dies.
He won't get out of Georgia before he's arrested for possessing obscene materials, I think you mean. Yeah, finally, I have passed, I think, 50 hours on Final Fantasy 13. I actually made a really sincere effort to finish that this week, and I'm getting a lot closer. So I still like that game a lot, but it's been, man, I've been playing that game since like March. It's just been a slow burn. I leave it for weeks, I come back to it. Oh, it's still fun. I'm going to play it for a while, and then, you know, other things come along. But
again, it must be harder to fit in the DQ9.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I can play DQ9 while I watch a shitty movie on Netflix, you know. But, yeah, Final Fantasy, you know, I have to sit down and turn on my PS3.
Do you have, like, a minute point in the movie where you're like, maybe I'll just start playing Dragon Quest now?
If it gets really crazy, or if it has, you know, if it's foreign, I won't do it because I need to read the subtitles.
Sure,
but
I
tend to only play, and I played Mother 3, I was playing on my netbook, and so I played that during movies also, but, yeah, I tend to only play video games during movies when I know the movie will demand a fraction of my attention.
I just like the idea of some sort of continuous assessment. It's like, oh, this 20 minutes hasn't been very... You've got 10 minutes to book your ideas up or the DS is opening again.
No, usually I've decided even before I start the movie.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Anyway, that's all I've got. James, it's all yours.
So, as I teased in the last episode, I have started, or, well, now I've completed Professor Layton and the Unwound Future.
there is track record for just gobbling these up.
Yeah,
I have not 100%ed this game yet. It will happen eventually, but at this moment I have set it aside. So, first off, these games are kind of like going on vacation to like your favorite resort spot, where it's like you kind of forget how much you really enjoy it there. And then when you're there, you're like, this has been the best weekend ever. And then when it's over, you're kind of sad it's done.
Yeah.
And then like next year, it's vacation time again. You go like, I forgot how great this is. This is the best weekend ever.
Yeah, but for a lot of people, it probably is a bit less like that. It's probably more like a country house that they go to every weekend for a season or something, rather than just like this 2-day very rapid vacation that it is for you.
Now, to be fair, it was 2.5 days, thank you.
James, oh, wow. I really do think you consume most video games differently than other people, but Layton in particular, I think your zeal for plowing through these Layton games is maybe very rare.
The puzzles in this game really don't ramp up until late in the game. I might not be the best judge of this.
Because you're a super genius.
No.
A Layton veteran as well.
Yeah, that's true. But there's less of the dumbass, hey, you'll never guess this because the whole thing's a trick puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were in the second game, which has a ton of those.
Yeah, those annoy me, honestly.
I think I've seen like 5 total, and I've gone through about 110 puzzles. So that helps, because those were always the ones that held me up, because once I was realized that they weren't trying to trick me on every puzzle,
mm-hmm.
I didn't have that 2 minutes of going, where's the trick here?
Yeah.
What are they trying to pull?
Right.
What bullshit's going on this game?
I think anyone who's played Professor Layton knows exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so it'll be like somebody ate my hamburger. Which one of these 4 people did it? And then they'll say a truthful statement, and then you have to realize the entire thing, everybody's telling the truth and nobody could be lying. And then you actually have to tap the character who's asking the question because you ate your hamburger.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
That's the kind of stuff that they pull. But in this game, there's considerably less of that
in
Diabolical Box. So Greg, this game comes out, what, like late October?
2 weeks from now, yeah.
With a different name.
It's The Lost Future, which
yes.
is kind of boring title.
Which is
really.
The third name this game has had, because in Japan, it's The Last Time Travel.
Yeah.
Which, none of these titles make any sense.
No, I think The Last Time Travel makes the least sense.
Isn't it like The First Time Travel? I mean, maybe first and last. I hope so, unless it's just like a really routine thing in the Layton universe.
I mean, people here now, if you haven't played a Layton game, either you just don't care, or you're a fool and you need to go out and buy the first one. Because it's stupid that these games are as good as they are. I mean, it's just a bunch of puzzles strung together by a plot that will inevitably make you upset. But
it has to, really. Although, as I've said before, the resolution in the first one was surprisingly satisfying.
Apparently, the second one
is a little more tenuous than that.
The second one is just balls to the wall. Well, I mean, the first one's balls to the wall crazy.
Yeah, but in the whimsical world of Layton, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, at this point, you know, you just sort of accept it, and that's just how these games have become. But for whatever reason, these games come out to be an amazing package. I mean, everything from the art to the music to even the puzzles themselves kind of fit into the theme of the game pretty well. I don't know. I mean, there's just something about the whole construction of the series that makes each game better than it has any real reason to be.
In other words, they're more than the sum of their parts.
But beyond that, they're
way more than the sum of their parts.
Yeah, I suppose.
This is like an auction. way more.
But the point's more that there's no reason why a game of this type should be this good either.
Yeah, it really does fit into the category of you know, giving you something you didn't know you wanted.
Yes.
Especially for me with the first one. And I actually skipped the second one. I kind of just, and this is not an explicit conscious thing, but I guess I just employed my Castlevania protocol. But I skipped the middle ones for GBA and DS.
Oh, yeah.
So it's just kind of what I do, I guess. And now it's been, God, the better part of 3 years since the first one came out in America, because I imported it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't wait for really long for it to come out in Europe, so I'm really looking forward to getting down to some Layton.
So it didn't hit me because I played the first one considerably later than when the game came out.
You played it a little bit at the time. You talked about it
on
the show.
Yeah, a little bit.
But you didn't go mental on it until much later.
And then it really blew up on me later. So all my memories from playing that game are right before 2 came out.
Yeah.
And then I played 2, like, almost immediately thereafter.
Yes.
So I did this weird, like, union of 2 titles that towards the end, you're like, bah! And then the second time you get there and you get the exact same response and you think, why did I let it get me again? But what I was trying to say was, it didn't hit me until just now that these games really are, like, on the ultimate yearly cycle. I mean, this game came out 15 days to the year before its second, the second one.
Yeah, they are now. I mean, as I said, the first one was a bit different because it came out way before it did in Europe at the beginning of that year, February 2008.
Yeah, and then it blew up somewhat later.
Yeah, there was that kind of remark. After it did well in Europe, they remarketed it in America with Lisa Kudrow or something, and, yes. and you know, had a second life. And that, and then I think that really convinced them, okay, let's standardize this. Let's formalize it. Let's get it out every year, relatively close, America and Europe. And yeah, certainly they've done really well in Europe, continue to do so.
I think Leighton is probably what Mary Louise Parker's playing in Weeds. She's always got her DS out.
But wait, I mean, it's that show spans more than 2 days, right? Well, then why is she still playing?
She, I don't know if you've seen the show, but she's got other things to do.
I don't know. I mean, I really enjoy the game. It's kind of a blur to go through the whole thing that quick. But yeah. It's the amazing thing is how they continue to be inventive with these stories that while they are what they are. I mean,
yeah.
Without ruining this one. I mean,
well, what, James? I mean, the really important question is, how do you feel about adult Luke?
Adult Luke is much more tolerable than young Luke, uh-huh. to be honest. Which worries me because the next three titles have even younger Luke than the current.
Oh, really?
Luke, so,
like baby Luke.
the
baby Mario, move aside. There's a new most annoying character in town.
The next game is when Luke met Leighton, and then they go up until the first game. So the next three are that time frame.
Maybe Luke talked like this until he met Professor Layton.
It's a Phantom Menace move coming up, basically.
Oh, God.
Nice. Actually,
young Luke can't be nearly... So I always wonder, if you played the first game, there's a character called Flora that they pick up towards the very end of the game, and she follows him into the second game. And I always wondered why it is they always abandon poor Flora in, like, the most inopportune moments.
They're just not interested in girls.
Yeah. But Flora plays a role in this game, and after hearing her voice actor, it's immediately apparent why they abandoned Flora. Because she's the most annoying character in the Leighton franchise.
There's a lot more voice work now. I mean, it's probably going to be quite a shock for me going from 1 to 3, because I think they've expanded the percentage of stuff that's voiced.
There is a lot of spoken word in this game.
And of course, I'm going to get to... I imported the first time, and this time I'm going to get the different Luke voice.
That's right.
Because it's different in Europe.
Greg, you're going to get the slightly better, but oddly
less entertaining.
Well, the European version that I've heard struck me as being not quite as British sounding, oddly enough. And maybe it's just because it's more natural and it's not as forced, you know.
Yeah, it's still probably like a 40-year-old woman doing the voice.
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, I don't know how natural it's ever going to sound.
Yeah.
That's my favorite part of the Flora character, though, because in this game, they basically stopped even trying to fake the British accent. She just doesn't. It's amazing.
I wonder if that'll be different as well.
It's gotta be, because it's so bad. She's the worst delivery ever. But for whatever reason, I played through that game, I really enjoyed it, and then when I was done, I was like, well, I've got about 40 puzzles to finish off, and then... Oh, I've got a year now.
Well, you got all the downloadable ones, right? The quote, downloadable.
Those are hard, though. Those puzzles, the weeklies, historically, those are really difficult.
Well, they're for the high-tier players, you know, like you.
Tier 1?
The Tier 1 operators, yes.
Yeah.
Tier 1, it's day 365, Leighton.
I'm curious how they're going to handle the 3DS game, because it looks like it's headed towards launch window in Japan.
Well, Devil's Flute's been out there for quite a while.
About a year now. Yeah,
I guess they're due for the fifth one over there.
Yeah, and we're due for that game, so I'm curious if they're going to try to force that one out quickly and then get the 3DS game out
behind it. Well, if it's going to be on... I mean, the thing is, Devil's Flute, is that is the first one of Level 5's own published?
Probably.
Because I assume it was just like a three-game deal, so... It's the whole issue of Nintendo's, you know, as we've said, getting that annualized kind of schedule down kind of goes out the window now because,
well,
just from the point of view of localizing it.
I don't see Level 5 starting up its own American self-publishing division.
They already did.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
About 3 months ago.
The rules of the game
have
changed.
I missed that news.
There's Level 5 North America and Level 5 Europe's opening. I guess it's opening like this month.
I know it's very odd to grasp the concept of a sort of very aggressively expanding Japanese company these days, but there is one that's doing these things
that
shows
ambition. There was a story about a month ago about Level 5 getting their sweet new digs, and those are like the swankiest offices I've ever seen. What's amazing about the level 5's growth is they basically said, you know, Nintendo, we signed a contract with Nintendo to publish the first 3 Layton games in the US, and we made somebody else a lot of money. That was basically the premise for them opening a North American and European office, is that Layton made someone else besides us a lot of money. We're not going to have that anymore. We're going to make our own damn cash.
Well, it'll be really interesting because, I mean, that's a chance for them. They could swap out the entire voice cast. The writing style could be very different. And as we've said, the scheduling for releasing those games could catch up with Japan.
I would think they wouldn't mess with the voice cast much, because I think at this point, at least like the main characters are kind of set. I mean, it would be weird if they changed Layton's voice, because that's actually a relatively decent voice actor.
Oh, yeah.
They'll have to change Luke's, because Luke is a kid. He's getting younger.
Right.
And I don't know what other characters are going to carry over, so they might have to have changed anyway.
Well, I personally am... I certainly like Layton. I've only played the first one. In terms of when I will get back into the series, I'm kind of tempted to just wait for the 3DS one, because I know that one will be, you know, for obvious reasons, it will be significantly different from the first one. Whereas the second and third ones that we've got in English now are... there's so much like the first one. I mean, I know, James, you can observe these little differences because you're so intimately familiar with them. But for me, it's going to be, you know, I haven't played Layton in 2 years. I'm not going to really notice the difference. It's going to be exactly what I remember. And
yeah.
I like Layton, but I don't need just more puzzles. I need, you know, I want it to play a little differently. I want it to bring something new to the table. So either with the RPG in the fourth one, or the 3D puzzles and stuff like that in the fifth one for 3DS.
All right, so the other game I've been playing, because, you know, 2 days of Layton, I need a new game.
There's still a lot of the week left to fill.
That's right. I've got 5 other days to fill. We have to get on this. I went and procured Final Fantasy The Four Heroes of Light, which I suppose I'm reviewing. This game is hard. I mean, this is like a really, really old school RPG wrapped in like cute modern graphics. And the game looks like a watercolor painting, and it's really, really attractive. Mm-hmm. It's really well polished. But this game is so hard. Holy crap. So like the entire first part of the game, you're just going to die over and over and over again.
Wow.
Because it hates you. But the advantage is that, you know, there's the idea that games either can be really hard or really punishing, but if they're both, the only people who will like them are masochists. This game is really difficult, but there's very little punishment for death. So you lose some gems, which you get from beating enemies, but it's not a catastrophe. And you basically get sent back to the nearest town, which is usually only about 5+ minutes from where you were anyway. And you keep all your experience. So it's just like, I get to go walk back there. So for the first 2 dungeons, I was just getting mangled just constantly and walking back to where I was. I'd get a little bit further, and then I'd get knocked out again. I'd get a little bit further, and then finally you'd get to the boss, and after a couple passes, you get through there.
Well, do you think it's because you were playing the game wrong? I mean, were you kind of using the wrong strategy, or had you just not leveled up enough?
Early on, it was kind of the wrong strategy I was using. I mean, you start out, if you're not familiar with the game at all, they've sort of got a backdoor class system in this game using what they call the crown system, mm-hmm. which is as you progress through the game, you gain access to hats, or crowns to be specific. I don't know why this has become a haberdashery game, but it sort of has. These crowns, when you assign them to a character, transform their class. So right now I've only got like 5 or 6, but early in the game you don't have any. So everybody is just what they call freelancer. And that means they get no stat boosts. They just are. But once I had a white mage, I get the white mage's hat, I was able to sort of develop a strategy around healing your allies and engaging in combat. So the battle system itself is really simple. You don't even get to pick who you're attacking. You just pick that they attack or that they heal. And by default, they'll heal the ally who has the least health. I don't know what mechanism they use to determine whom they attack, but they do. But it actually works pretty well for some reason. But it's kind of finding a strategy in that really restrained combat system that gave me the ability to push through the first 2 dungeons. Because once I got that, I was able to kind of force my way through them.
There are a lot of different hats, aren't there?
I think there are 30.
Yeah, that's... I mean, in terms of like a job system, that's a hell of a variety.
Yeah, right now I have like 6, and I'm only using 3 of them. But, I mean, at some point I'm going to have to experiment with them.
And you can upgrade them too, right, with those gems?
Yep, you can use the gems to upgrade both your weapons and your hats and get better stat boosts out of them.
It sounds like it might get to be pretty interesting as you open up more of this stuff.
In theory, this could be a really deep game despite its relatively simple exterior.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's weird about the game is that, well, it's weird. I mean, like the story itself is just goofy. I mean, and not like, let's just be silly, funny, goofy. It's like, just weird things happen to these four characters. Because they're constantly being told, hey, you guys are supposed to be the heroes of light. Go out there and be the heroes of light. And they're like, yeah, we're gonna split up. See you later. And then just bad things happen to them when they're separated. And they just keep running into each other. So a lot of times they're moving in groups of two. And one person's incapacitated, or one person's been transformed into a plant. I mean, it's just bad things happening to four kids who basically are supposed to be working together, but generally don't. I mean, it doesn't really give you a lot of direction like an older RPG doesn't. So it's like an early NES RPG where it's like somebody will mention a city to you and kind of tell you, it's in the north. Well, that's pretty much the only hint you're going to get that you should go there.
Well, that was always the premise of this game, right? Is that Square kind of wanted to go mm-hmm. back and not exactly remake the original Final Fantasy, but sort of take people back to the feeling of how games were back
right.
then.
So that's, I mean, it's called Gaiden in Japan, which is, makes sense,
mm-hmm.
really. What's amusing about the game is that at least for the last few hours, since we've had these split parties where basically party member A and B and C and D all go off in different directions and they just sort of keep swapping the people they run into, is the entire game is being told in these side stories right now, which is kind of an interesting storytelling that I don't think I've ever seen Square Enix do in a game. So the whole thing feels like it's going forward even though you aren't doing a whole lot. It's a perfect handheld game because you can complete these very episodic side stories, you know, in an hour. Hmm. And there's a ton of save times. And then you get jumped to the next side stream. You're like, okay, that's good. I can save here and I can come back and do the next session. So the whole game feels episodic despite it having a very linear motion of story, if that makes sense.
Interesting.
It feels like there's a lot of depth in here that I don't get yet. But eventually I will.
Well, you can give us an update in a couple weeks then, or a couple of days when you've played 80 more hours of it.
I'll send Greg an updated audio file when I beat it after the recording today.
Yeah. We'll keep the Facebook group updated daily, maybe, on your progress.
Hourly.
Yeah.
Update. Game's over.
All right. So that's all for new business. When we come back, we're actually going to have a special interview that Carl Castaneda did with the producer of DJ Hero 2 when he was recently out in California to play the game. Impressions are on the site, but you can also get some more information. All you have to do is just keep listening. During the break, we'll play that and then, of course, come back for part 2 of the Big RFN show with your listener mail.
Hey folks, Carl Castaneda here. Last week, NWR was invited out to San Francisco to play DJ Hero 2 at an Activision event downtown. I was able to get some great hands-on time, and towards the end of the evening, I got a chance to speak with Doug Ruthmacher, an associate producer over at Activision, about the driving development philosophy on DJ Hero 2, what's new in the sequel, and even a bit on what we can expect in DJ Hero 3. Remember to head on over to NintendoWorldReport.com to read my detailed impressions, but in the meantime, here's me with Doug Ruthmacher. What is the driving sort of philosophy with the development for DJ Hero 2?
There's a couple points. We like to say there's three main pillars.
Mm-hmm.
There's the music, mm-hmm. there's freestyle gameplay, and then there's social gameplay. So the music kind of speaks for itself. It's the foundation of the game. The soundtrack is, once again, it's brand new. It's like it wasn't DJ 1 exclusive to the game. You're not going to get it anywhere else.
Right.
DJ 2, the soundtrack, is going to be much more current, much more contemporary. We're hoping it has a much farther reach than it had in the first game. As good as it was in the first game, it, you know, won a bunch of awards in categories like best gaming soundtrack and won a lot of awards in best music game. But it's going to be a lot more current, a lot more contemporary stuff. More stuff you would hear on the radio.
Right.
One fun fact we like to throw out is that we, as part of our research, we basically took all the individual tracks in DJ Hero 1.
Right.
We added up all their collective YouTube hits.
Mm-hmm.
And in DJ 1, the soundtrack totaled up to about 300 million YouTube hits.
Mm-hmm.
We did the exact same exercise on DJ 2, and it came out to about 1.4 billion YouTube hits.
Wow.
So it kind of goes to show that you're going to just stuff that you're much more familiar with that you're gonna recognize easier. You know, Lady Gaga, Kanye, Snoop, Dre, just all across the board. A lot of great content. And then in regard to social gameplay, this is a big push, is to make DJ Hero a much more social experience. It's
right.
About, we really want to bring the party out of the living room. We want to allow players to experience the great music with their friends, with their families, online, offline, in all these different ways. So we have a couple different ways to support that. We have a deeper level microphone integration.
Right.
The microphone integration in DJ 1 was very simple and straightforward. You could basically MC over the top of any song.
Mm-hmm.
Now in DJ 2, most of these songs, I'd say almost all of them, support on-screen lyrics. So you can sing along. You're going to be scored separately from the turntable score, but you're going to be scored based on like pitch detection and note detection and stuff like that. Just like you would see in any other music rhythm game. So it has
right.
a much more robust vocal experience to it. We also have a lot of different multiplayer modes. We have, in DJ 1 we have one multiplayer mode, in DJ 2 we have six. So we, instead of the standard head-to-head mode
right.
that you saw in DJ 1, we have that again. We have like a streak mode, which will score you based on your highest note streak. We have a checkpoint challenge, which will break the mix up into different sections and score you on those individual sections. We also have a DJ battle, which I showed you upstairs, which is
right.
it goes back and forth, kind of designed to emulate like a real DJ battle you would see in a club, which is represented on screen like you saw. You'd be playing My Highway's Blank and I'm
exactly,
watching you,
yeah.
and it goes back and forth. It's kind of that call and response type of gameplay, which is, it's a lot of fun to play. The mixes were made specifically for that mode, and that mode is exclusive to DJ 2. You don't really see that in any other music rhythm game.
Right.
Party play mode, which you saw as well, it was introduced the first time in Guitar Hero 5, that real casual, cooperative, accessible jump in, jump out.
Right.
The game basically will, if you boot up that mode, it'll go into kind of this visual set list that you basically just see the whole game go run by itself minus the highway, so the music's playing, the dances, dancing, light shows and everything.
Right.
So you can jump in and jump out, one turntable, two turntables, microphone, any combination of the three.
Right.
And just a lot of different ways to bring people together and bring the party out of the living room.
Great.
And then lastly is freestyle gameplay, which is really the scratching and crossfading and sampling. And those certain sections where you see the icons represent that, you can actually scratch on your own. However you hold down the button and wiggle the platter back and forth, it's going to register that movement. And you're going to hear that in the game. Same thing with sampling, same thing with crossfading. It works the same way. Once you crossfade to the left, emphasizing one track, to the right, the other track, and in the middle you hear
right.
both. But now instead of following along with what you see on screen, you can do it however you want. And so those are kind of the three big pillars. And in terms of like kind of overall design direction, those are the big areas we wanted to go. We wanted to make music more current and contemporary, farther reaching,
right.
allow creativity through the freestyle gameplay, and allow players to kind of put their own spin on it, no pun intended.
Of course.
And by no pun intended, I mean I use that all the time.
Of course.
And so there's that, and then obviously the social element of bringing people together to experience the music in different ways. So those
okay.
are kind of the three main pillars.
So aside from just adding those, what about DJ Hero 1? Do you feel like it was one? Was there any area of DJ Hero 1 that like was perhaps a problem in its primary release that you've corrected or altered in its sequel?
Nothing I would say is a problem. Definitely, we found things that people liked and found ways to improve upon that. So
right.
like everybody loved the core gameplay and the scratching, the sampling, the crossfading, like
mm-hmm.
the fundamental gameplay. Everybody loves that. But a lot of people asked, for example, can I mix it myself?
Yeah.
And you know, obviously we still do the heavy lifting for you and the mixing for you, because we want everything to sound fantastic all the time. But like in certain sections, we're allowing players to scratch on their own and crossfade
mm-hmm.
on their own and sample on their own. So we're addressing that want from the community a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing in regards to social gameplay. People say like I want ways to get more involved with my family and my friends when I'm playing. And so that's
mm-hmm.
we're supporting that through the social aspects of it, through the different multiplayer modes, different ways to play, different methods of scoring,
right.
And getting up and singing as well. So things like that.
Well, you know, in regards to the first game, one you know, criticism that I heard often was that there was the barrier to entry was a little bit high,
mm-hmm.
where it usually took an hour or two before you started feeling comfortable with it. In my case, like when you were demoing the game upstairs, I mean, I really felt like I got into it really mm-hmm. quickly. Was it a conscious decision to make the game more accessible for this version?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously trying to make the game as accessible as possible. It's mm-hmm. always the two things we're always kind of going for is accessibility on one end
mm-hmm.
and authenticity on the other end.
Right.
And we have we had a pretty well received tutorial in the in DJ1, which was a nice way to get players slowly kind of introduced to the mechanics and fundamentals of DJing.
Right.
And we kind of followed suit the same thing in DJ2. Allowing players to get into it and just trying to make it as accessible as possible. And through the progression as you play through the game, you know, definitely starting with simpler, right. more straightforward songs and getting more complicated as you get to the end. And at the same time, having a very wide range of difficulties like we had in DJ1, starting all the way from beginner going all the way up to expert.
Mm-hmm. So now we're going to get into the more detailed questions that we've got from the NWR cool. staff. So first of all, like how have you changed the controller for this game, if at all?
We haven't really changed core functionality. We haven't changed it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Our party bundle, which comes with two turntables and a microphone in the game, the turntables in that bundle have mm-hmm. a different color finish on it.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, the functionality is the same. One of the main goals behind that was to not leave anybody out. We didn't want to have to make people run out and buy new hardware again. So mm-hmm. if you bought the hardware for DJ1, it's going to work in DJ2.
Mm-hmm.
Any sort of you know, as you go through the production process for the hardware on the second iteration, we're going to put in a lot of polish on it. So if,
make it a little bit more sturdy, a little bit more.
Anytime you go through that iterative process, there's going to be some subtle improvements on that regard. But for the most part, core functionality is the same. We really wanted players to, if they had the first game, they can just go out and buy the software if they want to and
just jump right in.
Yeah,
great. All right, so was there more of an effort this time around to not reuse songs as much as in the mixes?
Yeah, absolutely, there was. You're going to see a lot less reuse than you saw in DJ1, and that's pretty much it. We don't reuse the songs as much, and we think the soundtrack benefits a lot from that.
Great. And, I mean, the one thing with the vocals is that seems like it could possibly be an issue to me was that, you know, you've got a lot of these freestyle things going on in the game,
mm-hmm.
and so the rhythm is being subtly altered a lot. How has that affected the vocal track? I mean, for me personally, like in a rhythm game, you know, what helps me sing along with the track a lot is, you know, by keeping up with the rhythm. So if it's not constantly being altered, but it being altered subtly, how have you made it so that someone can easily follow along with the vocal track?
Basically what we do, that's a very good point. Obviously if you're scratching, crossfading between different tracks, sampling over or certain sections over and over and over again, it's going to be different. So like if you're singing something, it's going to sound different than you hear it on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
The lyrics that we intend players to sing are right. supported on screen, mm-hmm. so you're just gonna follow along on screen with what you see. And mm-hmm. obviously, like, you know, if you play a song more than once, it's gonna become more familiar with you and stuff like that. But the lyrics that are displayed on screen that you're supposed to see are built around all the scratching and all the DJ elements, so it allows you to sing along with what you're hearing and not have too much difficulty with that. And, you know, we think it's a fun, unique challenge to it, because obviously, like, you're going to be singing something. It's going to sound different than what you heard on the radio, so that's
right.
kind of a unique challenge to the game.
Great. All right, so tell me about the Empire mode in this game.
The Empire mode is basically our career progression, and it's about starting as kind of like a small warehouse DJ and expanding your career and watching this mm-hmm. basically creating like a DJ brand and watching it evolve
mm-hmm.
as you play through the game. So you're going to start obviously at smaller venues.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get grander in scale as you go through the game. You can pick different types of branding imagery that is associated with your DJ and your empire. And mm-hmm. then as you play through the different venues and go to different venues all over the world, you're gonna see that branding become more prevalent in different areas.
Right.
And stuff like that. This is also, you know, how you unlock all most of the musical content. A lot of it's unlocked when you start the game, but this is, you know, the stuff that isn't unlocked through Empire mode, through progressing. That's how you're going to unlock that. All the, you know, the venues, the different DJ accessories, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
So, aside from just the core functionality of the game being different, how has it changed from the first game?
In terms of Empire mode,
right?
It's pretty similar to the first game in that regard,
mm-hmm.
but. Yeah, it's basically about, you know, finding your brand and watching it kind of grow throughout the environment as you play through.
Okay, great. And we already covered, you know, just attracting a wider audience.
Uh-huh.
going through development, what would you say was the biggest hurdle in trying to find a wider audience with this game?
I would probably say the biggest hurdle was just trying to figure out what everybody wanted to see, what they liked, what they didn't like, what they wanted to see more of, and kind of and sort of streamline that into a couple things that we could focus on. And I think we did a good job with that. We wanted to make the music have a broader reach. We wanted to take the core functionality and allow some creativity through the freestyle gameplay in certain sections. We wanted to make it a more social experience, so we have all these different multiplayer modes and microphone integration. But just in the beginning, in the early stages of development, you know, targeting those areas and really executing those, I mean, it's kind of similar process anytime you're going to go into any sort of game development is just to figure out what everybody wants, what they want to have, and obviously there's going to be disagreements and back and forth on that, and then kind of get everybody aligned around the same goal and working towards that.
Mm. All right, so for people who have the first game and are thinking about whether or not to go for the next version, what would you say is the key new feature for this release?
It really depends on who you ask. It'd be one of the three things. It'd either be the music, it'd either be more current music, it'd either be the freestyle gameplay, because you can, you know, people love to scratch on their own and sample and crossfit on their own. And then the new multiplayer modes are very compelling too, like that DJ battle that I showed you upstairs turns heads a lot when people see the mixes kind of represented in that way. Me personally, I can't say, it's a toss up. I like the new music. I like being able to freestyle in certain sections when I like, and I like the new multiplayer mode. So those are kind of the three big areas, kind of like the three main pillars that I talked about. Those are the if I had to pick one, I'd say I'd pick three, and those are them.
All right. So as far as downloadable content, are we just going to be seeing more tracks, or what sort of downloadable content are we going to be seeing down the line?
We're still working on finalizing the scope of our downloadable content plan. It's definitely going to be new music. We're always looking into different ways to and different types of content to release. So I can't speak specifically about it right now. Other than say that we're very much behind it in support of that. And you're going to see probably a much bigger DLC push than you saw last year as we get into the end of this year and in the beginning of next year.
Great. All right, and so moving forward, I mean, obviously you guys are still very much working with, you know, like you said, downloadable content for DJ Hero 2, but is there anything you can talk about for the next game?
I can't talk about anything specifically other than saying that the direction that we took from DJ 1 to DJ 2 in terms of broader music, more creativity and customization, more social elements to get more people involved in the game, that's the direction we're going to continue to go as we take the franchise. So look for more things along those lines, but that's about as specific as I can.
So that's sort of like the focal point for the franchise going forward.
We really want to bring one of the things I always like to say about DJing is it brings all these different musical genres together and mixes them up and mashes them up and reaches a new audience. So we're definitely trying to reach broad audience. We're trying to enable players to be to have kind of creative mechanisms to display their creativity as they play through, and just find ways to bring people together to play it. So that's the direction we're taking the franchise.
Well, you know, you mentioned how there are so many more songs now, and it's a much different variety in songs you can get. What would you say is the most unlikely mix that totally works for this game?
The unlikely mix, there's a few of them. There was, and this is, these are kind of like my personal favorites. There is, and we just released, revealed our entire mix list, so I can talk about anything now. There is a mix that is Sean Paul Get Busy versus Axel F, the theme song from Beverly Hills, which is a pretty good one. That one jumps out of the speakers pretty good. RZA, who's one of our in-game playable characters, one of our celebrity DJs, did a mix that's Damian Marley, Welcome to Jam Rock versus the Fifth of Beethoven.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which sounds really, really good. Yeah. Those are probably the two that jump out to me the most. We did a Salt and Pepper Push It mix with Africa Bambaataa, which is a lot of fun. So there's a handful of mixes in there that really kind of jump out and that are a lot of fun to play.
Awesome. All right, so when can people get their hands on this game? When is it coming out?
It's coming out October 19th. It's going to come out on PS3, Xbox 360, and the Wii. And the three bundle options are software only, so if you have the hardware from one, you can play this one. The standard bundle, which is one turntable and the game, and then the party bundle, which is the game, and as we never get tired of saying, two turntables and a microphone. So those are the three options.
Awesome. And just one final thing. You know, someone who's not into maybe looks at DJing and is like, oh, you know, that's not really for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, how do you pitch them? How do you say, look, this is why you should try this?
We find that I find that most of the greatest barrier to entry is people just not understanding DJing that much. So when I you know, they understand guitaring, they understand strumming, right. They understand that motion. When they see the turntables and they see the mixer, they see all those buttons and all the knobs and everything, they can get kind of confused and make them kind of walk away. But we have a very straightforward, very basically simple experience when you get down to it. It's and we think once people get their hands on it and try it, they're much more drawn into it. I also like to think that, just as I mentioned before, DJing's great because it brings in literally any kind of genre of music and mixes it together. So it's not like, you know, we're only targeting certain genres of music. We're targeting everything. So it's really a good way to bring in any type of music you like. As long as you like music at all, there will be something in our soundtrack that you like.
Excellent. All right, man. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time to come
no
by.
No problem.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Well, John's not around, but we still have Now Playing for you. Of course, there's tons of great content, original content, at NintendoWorldReport.com from the past week. First up, actually, a bit of news that I just wanted to throw out there. We couldn't fit it into new business, but we just learned that Silicon Knights is going to be developing X-Men Destiny for Activision. One of the strangest news stories I've ever read. Definitely go check it out, and we will have continuing developments on that from New York Comic Con over the weekend, which will be happening after this recording. But of course, we'll have all the latest info on that from the con.
No word on where the camera will be pointed.
Neil Ronahan also has a review of Batman the Brave and the Bold for DS, speaking of comic book games, and he actually really loves this game. It's from WayForward Technologies, of course. They also have Shantae out this week, but Brave and the Bold, Batman for DS, Neil thinks it has amazing graphics, really, really clever sort of puzzle platformy gameplay. You're switching out characters and using all their unique abilities to get through the levels. Unfortunately, it's only about 3 hours long, but he still recommends it very highly just because of the sheer quality.
So we also have a blog from Aaron about the Kirby's Epic Yarn Room, which is basically one of Nintendo's ways of bringing in the media and promoting things. And it's quite amazingly fabric-covered room. Essentially, it's just Kirby art from the game. Well, just go look at it. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's a blog post, but it has a lot of photos in there, too, that are really worth checking out.
We also have Nathan's review of Legend of the Guardian, the Owls of whatever. I'm not in the business of reading made-up words. Which is a Wii game that he calls quite a pleasant surprise. I assume he figured out how to pronounce it from playing the game.
I do love the fact that you said, I'm not in the habit of reading made-up words, and then for Wii.
Well, that's true. At this point, I guess I just have to accept that that is the name of the console.
It's got tenure. Yeah. Neil returns in this edition of Now Playing with his review of Guitar Hero Warriors of Rock, which has the lowdown on the controversial quest mode and the party-friendly additions to Quick Play, including an overhauled roadie battle with Wii DS connectivity. We also have Zach's review for a DSi-specific accessory kit from Memorex, oddly enough. Find out which pieces of the kit are worth your money and which are destined for the dumpster.
That's it. Just a selection, a mere sampling of the great original content that our wonderful staff has been posting on the website this week. Go check out all of that and much, much more at NintendoWorldReport.com. Well, we are back for part two of the show, and of course, it's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and if you're not near a computer or a notepad, don't worry, I'll repeat it later in the show. So, Greg has the first letter this week, which we were going to do last week, but the show just was going so long last time. So we wanted to catch up because I think it's a good letter.
Deferred gratification.
Don't look at the man behind the curtain.
Voodoo writes, When discussing the next Nintendo Home Console episode 212, everyone seemed pretty certain that Nintendo would release its successor to the Wii in the next year or two. The Nintendo loyalists will certainly buy it without hesitation. But what incentive is there for a casual gamer to bite, especially if they don't already own a PS3 or 360? For presumably about the same cost as the new Nintendo system, a customer could buy one of the current gen systems and instantly have access to 5+ years of games releases that would be completely new to them. Is there a danger in releasing a new console, and therefore resetting the user base, when the competition has no plans to do the same?
I mean, there's always a danger in releasing a new console, even if the competition does reset. But I mean, they're facing the same situation with the 3DS right now. I mean, officially, Sony's not releasing a PSP2 in the immediate future.
Yeah, now, well,
at the very least, they're many months off of the 3DS from when it's coming out.
Yeah.
So they're kind of double confronting this problem. So I think what happens with the 3DS will greatly guide their hand with whatever the Wii successor is.
Well, actually, I think the 3DS telegraphs exactly what their challenge is and what their solution will be to the Wii situation, to the Wii successor, because 3DS is not just a more powerful DS, because that alone may not be enough to convince people to. I mean, it's not disruptive in the way that Wii was, you know, for GameCube, but they're adding this 3D technology that the competitors don't have right now, and is something that will make people want to spend a lot of money on a brand new system, even if it doesn't have an established software library.
Mm.
And that same thing applies to consoles, every console cycle. But I think as the market gets wider, the challenge is greater to convince people that they need. I mean, because with gamers, it's not hard to convince us that you need the new system. It's more powerful, right. It has all the new games, etc. For the average person who, you know, buys these things in Walmart on site, you have to do something a little flashier, a little more bold to get people's attention and to start the word of mouth network that propelled Wii to be such a runaway success. So they have to do something really shocking, and you know, they've got to make this gotta have it. It's going to be gadget.
Yeah, the hook. There's got to be a hook.
Right. It's going to be gimmicky. It's got to be.
But here's the problem that I foresee, and we've discussed this sort of fork in the road before, is that obviously they've had these sort of hooks for the last so many hardware devices that they've released. You've got the 3D without glasses, motion control, touch control, but although the DS is a little less easy to define because there's a number of things that kind of go into it, but it's not a given that they can find that for the next console in the near term.
Right.
I mean, there may be something that on cost terms is just a few years away. And so, as we've discussed before, the question becomes, do you wait until that time to release the new successor, or do you do something to kind of, you know, keep that revenue ticking over? As we said many times, Nintendo's hardware part of their business is different from many others because they're always making money from it, and you know, it's part of their revenue stream base,
right?
And you know, they are expected by their investors to maintain that.
So it's really interesting, Greg, the point that you're making, because you're absolutely correct, and I think it leads to maybe three different scenarios. First off, like you said, they may have to wait quite a while for the next major technology breakthrough to come along. And so maybe that's not enough. Maybe that's ready now. You know, maybe they're hard at work behind the scenes. They figured out what they want to do with it, and they're ready to go as soon as Wii sales dry up to that breaking point. I think the second scenario is they release some kind of stopgap unit. And
yeah,
you know, they kind of wave basically their hands and say, there's nothing to see here, it's just a better Wii. And that's sort of the Wii HD scenario, right? Like, it kind of does everything the Wii does, except just a little bit better. And they're not going to sell 100 million of them like they will with the Wii, but they'll sell something. They'll keep the investors happy.
That would be a situation where, first of all, you are obviously the Nintendo loyalist that Voodoo refers to. They're going to get it, right? And that's kind of probably who you're targeting the most.
Exactly.
And then also, it could be a way of offering, you know, kind of like the DSi and XL have done, you know, a premium choice
right,
for new entrants. So you're getting more revenue out of the people that are coming late to the party that can afford it.
Right, but they would be releasing something like that with the understanding that it's going to sell to a subset of their existing market. They're no longer expanding. They have to wait to expand the market because they don't have the technology ready.
But don't they run the risk of of going to the well too many times with that strategy?
I think the attractiveness of that strategy is dependent on how much they need to supplement hardware revenues, and how much that is a necessity is going to depend on, is the Wii going to just continue declining as it seems to be at the minute? Is DS going to decline really precipitously? And how well is the 3DS going to do?
Right.
All of those things are going to, you know, amount to what is Nintendo's revenue from hardware, and how much is it necessary to supplement that with something else in the console space, where there is going to be some sort of demand for it. I mean, there is. I mean, you know, a lot of us would probably buy...
Anything Nintendo puts out, there will be some demand for it. It's a question of, does it meet their needs? But the third option here is, as you sort of alluded to, Greg, you do something to sort of refresh the existing market. And that would be, I mean, it's very much what Sony and Microsoft are doing right now with Move and Kinect. They're trying to sort of release a new system without releasing a new system. And the problem for Nintendo is they've already tried to do that. And not just with Motion Plus, but really with kind of everything. And they did it with the balance board. They did it with the Zapper. They're going to try to do something with a vitality sensor, supposedly. They've done this so many times that it would be very difficult for Nintendo to come out with something as major as, say, Kinect, which is a major accessory. I mean, that is a $150 thing. It does something completely different than the system could do before. I mean, you know, whether it works well or not, whether it's success or not, it is a legitimate attempt to refresh that system and do something completely different with it. And it would be very difficult for Nintendo to come out and do something on the same magnitude for Wii, because it's difficult for them to differentiate that from all the previous attempts that haven't. I mean, you know, in the case of like the balance board, it was extremely successful, but short-lived. And with Motion Plus, I would say it wasn't even all that successful. So how do they release a new system without releasing a new system when they've already tried to do it five times? I think they're out of chances on that. They have to release an actual new console.
And then we get back into whether, you know, they've got the kind of, do you want to try and sort of force it if you haven't got that hook that you really want? Or are you going to try and sort of dress something up as a major kind of new feature when maybe it leaves something to be desired? It's very difficult to see immediately what they're going to do. The other issue that comes into play as well, which is clearly something they've stated many times, is that they are looking to, you know, not only appeal to people who were outside of the usual gamer base demographic before, but then kind of graduate them up to, you know, to be consistent gamers and to keep buying Nintendo products. If you don't put another Nintendo product out there, it increases the chance that if they have sort of cut their teeth on Wii, that they're going to graduate to the other systems.
Right.
You know, they might, if there's something Nintendo to buy that's new, they'd be inclined to that because it's what they know, maybe some kind of brand loyalty, whatever. But if that's not there, then maybe they start to just look beyond those borders, and once they're gone maybe. You know, so there's lots of different things to consider about, you know, getting something on the market in the next couple of years, and that's why I think it will happen. But what form it will take depends on a very great number of variables.
Right. Not least of which is Nintendo's own ingenuity, which is, you know, hard to argue with, but also hard to predict.
I think you could argue with their ingenuity sometimes and be right. Like I think legitimately they had no clue what the hell they were doing with the DS. I mean, we've discussed this in the past. It was like, here's something for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then they were like, holy shit, this made money.
And that may happen again with the console. You know, maybe they release something that is a stopgap, but it becomes such a runaway success that it almost leads them down a new path that they never could have predicted.
I'm not sure that it's as easy to do that, though, because the inherent cost of releasing a new console, even if it's just a revision, is substantially higher than a handheld revision. I think they would want to do a new platform. Because at the same time, you're already going to split your software base again. It's in a way much more dramatic than saying you have to have a Wii balance board to play this game. You are cleaving the software base off and saying this is a new console insofar as you have to have it to play these games. I'm not sure that a Wii HD really could generate enough market to get developer interest on this new, like, semi-console.
Yeah, I think definitely is a Wii HD going to, you know, cure some of the sort of third-party malaise that we've seen them talk about with respect to 3DS? Or, no way. That it would not be in any sense an answer to that.
Well, I mean, there is a very convenient way to do it, which is to make sure that it's at least powerful enough that it runs the standard development middleware platforms like Unreal Engine 3. I mean, that has been a huge, huge obstacle for Wii. I mean, third parties want to support it, but they're increasingly using these standardized development tools that the Wii is not powerful enough to support. And so they say, you know, well, we'd like to release Enslaved on the Wii, but we made it in Unreal Engine 3, and so it's not an option. You know, we'd have to completely re-engineer the entire thing. So I'm not saying that would be amazingly great for gamers to have yet another platform where you can get the same multi-platform titles, but if you want a quick, surefire cure for third-party support, make sure that your system can run the standard tools of the industry.
Yeah, but
that's a good place to start from.
Yeah, I would qualify that as a necessary but not sufficient condition.
Yeah, right, because right, then right. I agree.
At best, you're going to get sloppy ports.
Not necessarily sloppy, even. But I mean,
I think that most third-party displays with the Wii Remote have been sloppy. I think there is sufficient history to make my position unassailable.
Okay. I mean, I just think, you know, if you had a situation where they released something that was somewhat more powerful, you know, and it was for people that wanted to just, you know, upgrade the Wii, play stuff upscaled, and then they was going to release a subset of games that took advantage of this greater power.
Yeah.
In certain key sort of core franchises.
Like DSi kind of system.
But with some sort of more appreciable push in terms of, you know, retail games perhaps or something. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they would use it as a sort of digital foray for something more substantial than we've seen on Wii in that sense. Mm-hmm. But either way, it probably would be perceived as like, okay, this is like the player for a particular subset of Nintendo's games for Nintendo fans.
Right.
It's similar in the way that, you know, some of these past peripherals are really just tied for
the
individual games rather than a theoretical library of games. So I think it would end up following a similar sort of model, and the principal point of it from Nintendo's point of view would be to supplement hardware revenue and then some sort of spin-off benefit for software revenue, but really just on that sort of basis rather than building a new platform.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see Iwata tackle this topic, because I don't think, especially at E3, by the time of E3 next year, I don't think he'll be able to avoid it. He's got to, at the very least, he's got to say, well, here's the vitality sensor, we're going to sell some of these. You know, I think there'll be far more than that to discuss. But this is the kind of thing that he likes to talk about at E3, and that the investors expect him to talk about. He might even bring it up at GDC, although I kind of doubt it. It's a little early.
Mm.
I just feel like if they're going to release a console that's sufficiently powerful to run the current gen middleware, it would behoove them to just go ahead and do whatever it is they're going to do for the next console, because you're essentially going to make an expensive console that way, and then you're basically saying, yeah, but this is really just a holding pattern for now.
I think the problem as well, so specifically, you know, when you think about this situation, you have to think about it from a Japanese perspective.
Well, they really shouldn't, because if you look at the number of Wiis sold around the world, Japan is a pretty small fraction of that, and it would be pretty foolish of them to base the entire design philosophy of their next console around what works for Japan, because they're going to sell a lot more of them in America and Europe than they are in Japan, and they better make sure that their Western, non-Japanese fans and potential fans, new fans, are satisfied with what they do, because I don't think Japan's going to buy a lot of consoles no matter what. No matter what Nintendo does, no matter how much they try to cater to them, they could name it the Monster Hunter console, and they're not going to sell 50 million of them in Japan.
If it was the Monster Hunter console, they might.
No, they're not. They're not going to sell 50 million of them. Monster
this
Hunter,
is the exclusive platform
Monster
for
Hunter
Monster
sells
Hunter.
5 million of every game to the same 5 million people. I think Nintendo needs to maybe seriously consider what the non-Japanese markets expect out of a home console, because they're going to have problems if they focus, if they become slavishly devoted to this idea of reviving the Japanese console market. Because even, I mean, Wii was a pretty blatant salvo in that operation, and it hasn't even gone that great in Japan.
Haven't they always been slavishly devoted to the Japanese console market?
Yeah, but that market is shrinking more and more and more, and it's looking more like it can't be saved.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems like what they expect to work in that market works pretty well in other places.
Yeah, but I mean, their philosophy with the Wii was a response not just to what was happening in Japan. They designed that system to disrupt the entire world.
I think a stopgap console is probably the most self-defeating move they could possibly engage in.
But business-wise, it might be...
It might make the money in the short term, but I'm not sure how that's really going to benefit them as a long-term platform holder.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how DSi benefited them in the long term, but they did it.
In that case, though, it was just like, yep, here's another handheld. I think if you're launching a system that you're saying this is going to have games developed for it, it would be contradictory to everything they've done.
They've done it a lot before. I mean, if you read the books about this, about the sort of early 90s era, like in Power Up, Chris Kohler's book, or David Sheff's Game Over, they talk about how a lot of people, when the Super Nintendo was released, didn't want it. They didn't, you know, game developers, game consumers, a lot of people didn't really want Nintendo to put out a Super Nintendo because the NES games were still selling, the system was still selling, and it confused people. I mean, this was the first, you know, generation turnover since the crash, and people were worried that it wasn't going to take very well. And Nintendo was like, yo, we got to make this new system. We got to sell some more hardware. And so they did it anyway.
But now they have more competition than they did then, too. I mean, their competition at that particular era was inept.
Yeah, it was Genesis, yeah.
And this case, they have real competition. They can't just say, well, here's your stopgap console. Go ahead and buy this, and then come back in 3 years when we have our next great revelation.
Well, it's a very interesting topic. Thank you, Voodoo, for bringing it up. He actually has an extra little part to his letter where he's asking why I keep pimping the Facebook page. He says, you already have a website with a sizable following. Why is there exclusive content on Facebook? Do you anticipate listeners to follow you on Facebook if they don't already visit NWR? Yes. And I know for a fact that they do. The Facebook page is mainly a way for me, and for us, mainly me because I run it, but it's a way for me to interact with people throughout the week. So it serves a very similar function to TalkBack in that, you know, we record the show once a week. There's a gap between when we record it and when it's published. Things happen during the week. It's a way for us to stay engaged on a more daily basis. And it's a way to get people talking back with us who otherwise normally wouldn't because they don't use the forums. In some cases, these are people who found us through Facebook because they were invited by other friends, or maybe they even clicked on the ad that I ran for a month just because as an experiment. It was very cheap to do, so I ran an ad for our Facebook page on Facebook. And, you know, it's sort of a way to get other people interested in the show and maybe get them to interact with the show when they normally wouldn't. It kind of comes down to the question of why do we do any of this stuff? I mean, why do I care that we get new listeners at all? You know, I mean, we already have thousands of people who listen every week and who love the show. Why do I want them to tell their friends? Because it's not for my ego. I care that people like the show and that they interact with it because a lot of our content, including, of course, this very segment, is basically created by the listeners, or at least it's catalyzed by the listeners. We get these great questions and these great ideas. That's why we do Retroactive. That's why we have the poll and we don't just choose the game ourselves. Because I want to talk about what you want us to talk about. And we really make a real effort to do that, and I think that's one of the more popular parts of the show. And so in order to keep the show at a high quality, to keep fresh content coming in, to keep the ideas flowing, and to make sure that we don't repeat ourselves every week, we want people to write into
my job.
Yeah, that's also Greg's job. But
mission failed.
This show thrives on interactivity, and Facebook is just another way to do that.
By the way, I'm going to actually go in the forums and ban Voodoo, so he has to use a Facebook page to interact with us. So.
Well, I did want to make this point on the issue of exclusive content, because I am not on Facebook.
Yet.
As I've alluded to in the past, this is because I am far too uninteresting to have a Facebook
page. I disagree with you, Greg, because there are a whole lot of people who listen to you for 2 hours a week. So I don't think you're as uninteresting as you think you are.
Yeah, well, this is the limit of it, trust me, this qualifies. As Dennis likes to talk about, Dennis Dyack, a good friend, about reciprocity. You know, it's Facebook, I imagine, when it works well, is about people sharing their interesting things so other people share their interesting things, and I am unable to reciprocate, therefore it doesn't work. But I am still able to see this quote-unquote exclusive content. I mean, you know, despite not being on Facebook, you could still just go to facebook.com/RadioFreeNintendo and get to see quote-unquote exclusive content, like a picture of the Magic Cast where John's wife comes in and says, "Can it get any sexier than this?"
I mean, and the answer is yes.
You may or may not have been missing out on, and I'll leave it to everyone else to decide whether this is exclusive or not.
Remember, Facebook is a place where you can discuss things like your fandom of Clavier Gavin of Ace Attorney 4 and other bullshit like that.
Okay. Well, Greg makes a salient point. All the stuff there is public anyway. You don't actually have to sign up or join Facebook to look at it. The reason that we do it is to help people discover the show and to give people an alternate way to interact with us. If maybe for whatever reason they're not comfortable with the forums or they just don't know about them. I appreciate the concern, Voodoo, but if you don't go to Facebook, it's okay. You're not really missing out on anything.
Mrs. Lindemann disagrees.
All right. Well, the next email is from Leroy Pantweather.
Leroy?
I don't think that's his real name. Leroy Pantweather writes, "Hey guys, love the podcast. Been listening almost a year. Found it through iTunes, and I gave you all a raving review." Again, just to go back to the previous letter, this is why we ask you to write reviews in iTunes, because it helps people find the show, and that makes the show better. Anyway. "After listening to approximately 100 episodes in the past two weeks or so, and hearing the cry for email, I finally got the nerve to send my first one ever. I am your typical gamer and play a lot of RPGs, first-person shooters, and platformers. Recently, I went outside my normal box and tried Hotel Dusk, which has amazing music. I have not played this style of game since, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego for the PC? I'm not gonna lie, it's making me feel like a..."
Making him feel like he's intellectually challenged.
"Embarrassing but true, GameFAQs has been required on more than one occasion. So I was wondering, have any of you tried anything outside your normal wheelhouse that has made you feel like you are inept at gaming? Or are there any games in general that have made even the hardcore elite such as yourselves feel befuzzled at times?"
Who wants to go first? Because this will be interesting.
I've covered some of this stuff on the show. Presumably, it must have just got lost in the hubbub of 100 episodes in 2 weeks. I really hope that's some sort of typo. Killzone. I mean, you know, I hadn't played an FPS for ages. And, yeah, that was a learning curve.
Since before joysticks?
No, not really. Time Splitters 2 was the gap.
Yeah.
But it was still very, very different experience, and it just to be out of it for that long. And yeah, I mean, at times it was a bit of a steep hill to climb, but I still managed to enjoy that. So, I mean, it's something I tried to do.
I don't see you as a GameFAQ.
No, it's a seldom kind of thing. I certainly, for like, you know, when I play import games, I'll use it for some of this language stuff. I'm certainly not unfamiliar with the utility of GameFAQs, but I will try within reason to do it myself. You know, I do believe in that.
Personally, I don't think there's no reason to feel bad about using GameFAQs.
I don't feel bad about it when I do it. I want to give it a good honest try.
I mean like the letter writer seems to almost vilify that. I mean, it's your game. You paid for it. You should be able to get the most enjoyment out of it you can.
Yeah, well, I agree completely. You know, I actually use GameFAQs heavily, even on games I like. For instance, Dragon Quest IX, I mean, the alchemy in that game, you almost can't do it without GameFAQs. There's a lot of stuff that I don't even know if the recipes are in the game. If they are, they're very well hidden, or they're in the post-game.
It's like Pokemon type.
Yeah, exactly.
Pokemon's like Dragon Quest. Yeah.
Exactly. And you could totally play the game without doing it, but right now, that's kind of the part that I'm the most interested in, and I'm not going to play the game for 20 hours to wait for this recipe that I could just go online and get right now. So, James, what's a game that you has been out of your wheelhouse that challenged you?
Do I have a wheelhouse? I mean,
well, there's certain things that are definitely in it, like RPGs and flight sims and you know, that sort of thing.
But yeah.
What about Endless Ocean? That must have been a bit out of the wheelhouse.
That's sitting on my coffee table. I haven't played it yet.
I mean, it was heavily suggested to me by Carly that I should play that game, so I did. And, you know, it didn't challenge me. I mean, it's Endless Ocean.
No, it's not going to make you feel deficient in any
God
particular
damn
way.
God damn these sharks! I mean, it never really hit a point where I felt like I was being beaten by a game outside of my my realm of understanding. It's not a recent example, but I took a relatively long break from the strategy genre, and I jumped back in on Rome Total War, which to say is a complex game is an understatement. But to jump back in and immediately be like, I'm going to play this on the hard mode, and I'm going to get raped, which is exactly what proceeded to happen. I was blown away, and it was terrible. That was a while ago, and it didn't take me particularly long to figure out what was going on. I mean, I will use GameFAQs for things if it's just, like, something really obtuse. Like, if there were GameFAQs for Four Heroes of Light, I would have used them the other day when it didn't tell you where you're supposed to go. It just assumes you know.
Right. I use GameFAQs a lot as a cure for bad design.
In this case, the game doesn't have any because it just came out. But I think generally for me, it's not so much that I play games that are outside of some supposed wheelhouse. It's more that I play games that are extensions of stuff that I already play.
It's a branching out.
Right. So I might play something more complicated than I'm used to, or I'll play something that's related.
Well, James, has there been anything... I mean, retroactive is one way that, you know, we kind of jump into games that we might not otherwise play. Has there been anything that's come up so far that just kind of was just something that you probably would never play otherwise?
Well, Mother 3, but we've discussed that, that I have a strong dislike for Earthbound, so there was pretty much no chance I was going to play Mother 3.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really disappoint from where I was on Earthbound.
You know, certainly, like, Super Ghouls and Ghosts was one for me in retroactive where I just, you know, I had played that game before and I knew I didn't like it.
Because you're wrong.
Again, that's not possible by definition.
This is a democratic society.
and
you went 3-1.
No, I was outnumbered, at least on the show, at least. But, you know, that was a game where it's one of those games where I pick it up and I just feel totally unqualified to play it. For, you know, for whatever reason, I'm just like, wow, I can't play this game. I would like to contribute something more to the discussion than I'm going to, but I can't fucking play this game.
That's not really game factable either. Although,
no,
in a way, you can almost there. You can basically memorize every button you have. You could basically create a robot to beat Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
There are probably a lot of incidences for me because, for one thing, I do like to sort of, especially now with I've got Gamefly and it's easy to rent games again, I like to rent games that, you know, are like maybe even in genres that I've never played before, or they're just in series that I know very little about. And a lot of times I end up enjoying them quite a bit. Like in Splinter Cell, for instance, that was a game that I kind of put it on there just because I'd heard it was good. But I'd never really played Splinter Cell before, and I'm not really into, like, the whole stealth action genre anyway. But actually, I would go back farther. This was about 5 years ago. A friend convinced me to borrow from him Metal Gear Solid The Twin Snakes. And I've mentioned before, I tried multiple times to play the original Metal Gear Solid back in the late 90s. I rented it at least twice. And I never played it more than an hour. I couldn't get into it. It made no sense to me. I was failing. I didn't know why. I didn't know what I was doing wrong. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I didn't know why it was supposed to be fun. I just couldn't do it. And the key for me actually sort of starting to like Metal Gear Solid and actually finishing Twin Snakes and the two sequels, and actually all three sequels, is that this friend, when he let me borrow Twin Snakes for GameCube, he also gave me the strategy guide. And that is the first and last time I've used a printed retail strategy guide in over a decade. I mean, I had a couple when I was a kid, but I would never buy a strategy guide.
No, they're stupid.
But he just gave it to me. He already had it. And I started out, you know, the first time I popped it in there, and I wanted to play it because, you know, I knew Dennis. I was familiar with Silicon Knights. I loved Eternal Darkness. And I knew that this was a highly acclaimed game. There must be something to this. There must be a reason that people like this. I just have to discover that.
It's the narrative.
I put it in there, and the first 30 minutes, I'm like, wow, it's still not clicking at all. I don't understand what I'm supposed to do here. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I flip open the strategy guide, and from that point, I basically played it from the strategy guide. I basically just did everything that it told me to do. And in doing that, I learned to play the game, which I had never done before. I literally was playing it wrong. I mean, to the point where I couldn't make any progress. And I learned to play the game from that strategy guide. And from there, with Metal Gear Solid 2, I just used GameFAQs when I got stuck. But there were a lot of parts of it I could play by myself because I'd kind of learned the basic processes. With Metal Gear Solid 3, I played almost the entire game without any help at all.
Now, in the first game, were you just trying to run and gun everybody?
No, actually the opposite. I was afraid to kill anyone because I thought you weren't supposed to. And as it turns out, that is like the... I mean, there are like maybe a few people in the world who can actually play the game that way.
There are YouTube video series of beating that game without killing anyone. It's so hard.
Sure. I thought that was the way you were supposed to do it, and obviously I wasn't getting anywhere that way. So anyway, I think that's the ultimate example I can think of from my personal history of a game that I finally just bit the bullet and I said, somebody's going to have to hold my hand through this game, or I'm never going to see it. I'm never going to play it. And that first game, I don't know if I played it so much as I was sort of guided through it, but it sort of trained me to understand how that game is designed and how it works, and I was able to enjoy the rest of the series because of it. So I'm very glad that I did it. But I think there's something to that. I think if there's a game that you've tried multiple times and you just cannot do for whatever reason, maybe it's too hard, maybe you just don't understand it, or maybe you just don't like it, I think there's a potential benefit in just using a guide and just taking the easy way out, because otherwise you're not going to experience the game at all.
Oh, the Mega Man ZX. There we go. Okay. Because the game doesn't have a map.
Yeah.
Which is the pressing issue there. That the game is just broken.
Fair enough.
That's why I had to use a guide.
I mean, the most recent example for me is probably Monster Hunter. I gave that a go. Definitely didn't get into it straight away or anything. I haven't really gotten into using a guide for it or whatever. I don't know whether that would enhance my enjoyment of it or not. But a lot of the time, I've been pleasantly surprised. And, you know, RPGs, I've kind of gradually felt my way through those kind of...
Right.
You know, in some ways, certain types of games can act as a kind of bridge, almost perhaps in the same way as the strategy guide example. You know, if you can get into, like, you know, the sort of Mario and Luigi RPGs, which have that kind of action timing element to them, and they're very light-hearted, it can be a nice little gateway to somewhat more traditional RPGs.
Right. Okay, thanks for the question there, and Jim has the next question.
All right. So, Jim from Michigan writes, "It seems that lately, whenever I read a preview or review of a Wii game, on this site and others, meaning Nintendo World Report, there's always a mention that the classic controller is not only a viable option, but potentially a superior option to control the games. I know the Wii Remote's capabilities, or lack thereof, and the lack of Wii Motion Plus games have been discussed ad nauseum, but the classic controller mention has me curious. It feels that after 4 years and 70 million consoles sold, the developers are, for the most part, still not making games with motion in mind, opting instead to shoehorn motion controls into more traditional games where regular control does the job just as well, and choosing the Wii because of the lower development costs. Has Nintendo not been enough of a leader in this regard? Would third parties do this regardless? And will this ever end? Or will the classic controller be mentioned in every Wii game article from here on out?"
I love that compound question at the end.
Which is kind of funny, because I touched on this earlier when I basically said that third parties will never support the Wii Remote correctly, and that my position is unassailable in that regard. And I did so forgetting we had this question coming up later.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, there's a lot of games that either have classic controller support or people think it should. I mean, I think it's probably where the whole mention thing comes in, you know, and that can apply to a bunch of different kinds of games. I mean, obviously, there's, like, the side-scrollers, you know, sometimes they might not have classic controller support. I think, like, well, Wario Land Shake It doesn't.
New Super Mario Bros. Wii doesn't have classic controller support.
But it doesn't need it. I mean, you play it sideways.
look, there's a big difference. The Wii Remote on its side is not a great NES-style controller.
No, but it's
well,
it's
a Punch-Out, for instance, is another example. You know, you've got that breed of games where people say maybe it should have had the classic controller. And then you've got kind of the other side where, you know, maybe someone might have said it about the first No More Heroes. And, of course, the second one does have classic controller support.
Yes.
Which, yeah, I remember you preferred
it makes it
that
easier,
way, didn't you?
Oddly enough. But, yeah, it feels fine.
So, I mean, I think what that goes to on the sort of motion control end is just the kind of the limitations, as I mentioned in the question, of the Wii Remote. It's just that a lot of the time it's either very difficult or it's just not capable of reaching the level of nuance in the gameplay whereby you would say, well, this just couldn't be done with a traditional controller. And therefore, you know, there's either going to be literally a classic controller option or some people are going to sort of wish there was one.
Well, I remember when Wii first came out and Nintendo showed the classic controller, there was an understanding, especially when we first got to use one at E3 back in 06, there was sort of the implication that it was primarily there because of the Virtual Console, to have something that was more compatible, that was, you know, could be used for a wider variety of supported platforms on Virtual Console. And once it started to be adopted by some of the actual retail Wii games, which happened fairly early on, you know, with like the Metal Slug collection, some of that stuff that was around the launch window,
right.
A lot of people actually, I remember a lot of Nintendo fans became concerned that it might actually usurp the Wii Remote, that it was sort of a cop-out. You know, Nintendo designed this whole system around motion control, and yet they provided a very affordable, easy-to-develop-for way to not use motion control. And it's interesting, I haven't heard anyone reflect that concern in quite a while, but, you know, clearly, as Jim sort of proves here, it's still out there.
I think it's more that people at this point have just resigned themselves to it.
Maybe so. I think, for one thing, developing for the motion control part of the Wii Remote is more difficult than people originally anticipated.
Yes.
And so it's nice to have a fallback. Well, you know, we put this time into making the motion controls, but if we release the game and people kind of aren't very happy with how responsive it is or how well it works, at least we can very easily throw in this classic controller support and they have that option. And then, you know, that'll kind of tamper down some of the bitching and moaning about it from the gamers.
I mean, you just think about what would it take, given the existence of the classic controller, for someone to make a game whereby, you know, there's no kind of clamor for it at all.
You need a Boombox.
Yeah,
you need a game that's actually intelligently and exclusively uses motion control in a way to create a game that wouldn't be possible otherwise. And fortunately, we've seen very precious few examples of that on the Wii.
I agree. And I mean, I think there's two things to say about that. First of all, you give credit to, you know, the people at EA that made something like Boombox. And, you know, on the flip side, you know, perhaps you could reprimand the sort of collective developer community for not leveraging what is good about the Wii Remote more often, for whatever various reasons we've gone into and speculated about over the many, many episodes now. But on the other hand, I think there is a reality that what the Wii Remote setup is good at is a bit of a small play field.
Right. Much more than we originally thought.
Yes, right. Exactly. It is a little box in which, you know, you can operate that is going to deliver a game whereby, you know, because you have to deliver a game that, yes, you know, you think it couldn't be done another way, and it's effective enough that no one is going to think that they'd rather do it with a classic controller, and so the game developers aren't going to think about putting in that alternative, and no reviewers or people in the community are going to ask for it. And that's the, you know, when the classic controller's there and it's used in so many other games, that's pretty tough. So, I mean, it really does have to be something like Boombox to reach that. But I think just the existence of Wii Motion Plus is proof that box that the Wii Remote provides is a bit constrained.
Right.
You know, because Nintendo felt the need to blow it up, basically, to make stuff like Zelda.
And the sad thing is, Motion Plus does very adequately, I think, address the primary limitation of the original Wii Remote. I mean, it kind of is, as people said back when Motion Plus was first announced, it makes the Wii Remote do what you always wanted it to do in the first place.
Yeah,
right.
What they kind of led you to believe it would.
The problem is that it came out 3 years too late. And you know, it's an add-on. Some people have it, some people don't. It just creates this very unfortunate market fragmentation that makes it difficult for third parties in particular to justify making a game that depends on it.
You basically have to bundle it.
Yeah, and if they're not going to depend on Motion Plus, if it's not going to be exclusive to Motion Plus, then it's kind of back to the same issue of, well, we can support it, just like they can support motion controls in a lot of games, but we can't really design the game exclusively around it because we don't know for sure if the implementation is good enough or if people have access to it at all. And so here's the backup.
Yeah.
You know, and as you see with Red Steel 2, Motion Plus, even at that point, it's not a magic bullet to solve all the problems of motion control. You still have a lot of design issues. Even if the controls do exactly what you would want them to, it's still hard to make a game around motion control. And a lot of people still don't know how to do it. And look, I mean, look at the launch lineups for Move and Kinect. It's not any better on those platforms.
Chick sorting games.
Yeah. It's still an issue.
It is. And as we've seen, you know, I mean, even Nintendo has had scarcely any confidence to go into the Wii Motion Plus arena for very much outside of Resort and then Zelda down the line, which is obviously a huge franchise in itself. So it's got that power behind it. I mean, so you're kind of choosing between, you know, constraints here, aren't you? The constraints of the market with Wii Motion Plus or the constraints of the game design on, you know, with the traditional Wii Remote. And so it's proven to be that, you know, obviously in general, third parties haven't been too interested in Wii as time's gone on, but it, you know, they've been quite happy to just, you know, go for the bigger market and see what they can do with it. And I mean, some of that has been light gun games, which of course you're not going to hear people, you know, ask for classic controller support. I mean, that is one example.
Look at Sin and Punishment 2. It does have classic controller support. It's probably the inferior way to play it. But I don't know exactly why that's in the game.
Yeah, it shouldn't have been there.
I mean, I always felt that it's like, surely this is not in any way necessary. But again, I mean, that was, I think that speaks to how difficult it is, in a way, to kind of escape the shadow of the classic controller. Because even in a game like that, where I think, you know, we would agree, the three here have played it, the pointed controls work really well.
Right.
Seem like they're kind of unambiguously better.
Right.
The developers still might be thinking, well, there might be some people out there that prefer to play it this way, including Mr. Garnet Lee, who did.
He repented.
He did. He went back. But that in itself kind of shows almost the danger of it, doesn't it, though?
Yes.
Where you might put in classic control. So we'll say, oh, well, if it's got classic control, that's probably the real way to play, because that's kind of like the less obvious. It's the, you know, this is the more you're quote unquote hardcore. Or whatever. Mm-hmm. But certainly in that case, I mean, it's no contest for me.
It reminds me a little of the Wii Will Mario Kart debate.
No.
Where?
No.
I think using the Wii Will is clearly the worst way to play that game. And
only
yet,
scrubs use the Wii Will.
Well, and yet people use it because they think it's the proper way and they get good at it, you know, but I would say kind of pointlessly so.
I bet John uses the Wii Wheel.
It's one of these things that this is a modern problem. I mean, back on Super Nintendo, there weren't any games with multiple control methods. You know, this wasn't an issue, but on Wii, it's partly because of Nintendo's strange MO of releasing more and more and more and more accessories and add-ons to the controller.
Well, I suppose you could go back to NES with, like, Rob, you know, Gyromite and stuff.
Kind of, but they nipped that one in the bud pretty quickly, didn't they?
three games!
Hardly got away from them.
No.
Look, it takes everything I can to not buy a Rob at the video game repertory house nearby, because there's always at least three of them in the shelves.
I would love to have one as a trophy.
Yeah, that's really what it would be.
And plus, it was childhood fulfillment, because I never got one when I was a kid. It was kind of already, it was already passe by the time I got an NES.
No. It was that early period where they was trying to kind of distance the NES from the old failed game computers of the past.
Yes.
It's like, it's a toy, it's fun.
It was already passe by the time I was born. So the NES really isn't all that different, you know? There's one controller, and there was a zapper, and it came with the thing. And then there was the pad if you really wanted to be a track star.
Yeah, but the zapper and the power pad and Rob, these were all so niche. They were never adopted on
Well, and in the case of the zapper, it came with the console, so it was a non-issue.
Yeah, and Rob did too, for that matter. They never sold Rob separately, ever.
It wasn't like the goddamn Super Scope that you had to buy. And...
yeah.
And look like a dumbass when you played with.
But I suppose in terms of where it's going to go from here, you're not going to hear it mentioned with respect to Zelda. I mean, you know, I certainly hope so if it's going to be successful at all.
If that game is designed decently, then you shouldn't have people saying, man, I wish I could play this with a classic controller.
Yeah, I mean, there'd probably still be some.
Yeah.
But I suppose the funny thing is that really, you know, as we sort of enter this mature phase of the Wii's life, it seems like some of the kind of point and stuff is kind of on the decline, you know, maybe the
Which, that's too bad, because I still think for the stock Wii Remote, the pointer is actually a lot more exciting as a game design tool than
that's
the accelerometer.
Sort of applicability stuff. You know, stuff like World of Goo, that for me was always some of the most fun, but, you know, the RT stuff hasn't materialized, as we've mentioned before. The light gun thing's probably run its course at this point.
So
what we're getting into is, you know, side scrollers. So yeah, I mean, the classic controller's probably going to get mentioned plenty.
Mm-hmm. We also had that chain of adventure games that you use the pointer. And then
didn't work out so well commercially.
That dried up.
Well, partially that the adventure genre is still in resurgence. It's still doing well, but I think economically the smart way to release those games is digitally, and the Wii not as great for that. The days of Zack and Wiki on a retail disc are over, I'm afraid.
No, it's just so sad.
Actually, they never were not over, basically. But
Zack and Wiki was DOA.
Still one of my favorite Wii games.
Me too. I love
such
it.
A good game.
So maybe before we move on, I do want to say that lately I've been, you know, with the Classic Controller Pro out now, which is a great accessory. I think we all like it. Everybody who plays with it likes it, basically. I'm still shocked that I'm not surprised Nintendo hasn't done it, because it would be too confusing with all their other controllers. But I'm surprised that somebody like Nyko hasn't come out and made a classic controller with handles and everything, you know, like a nice classic controller with built-in Wii Remote functionality. I mean, pointer, speaker, motion control, everything. It's all in there, one unit, no fucking dongles, no cords hanging off of it.
Because you've never been to the Nyko E3 event.
They showed that? I've seen the Wing.
No, that's why they don't make it. If you've gone, you'd understand.
Because they lack the requisite skill.
Essentially.
They've made that Wing controller, which looks okay.
It's goofy as hell.
I'm surprised there's not an all-in-one unit that just does everything.
There is, actually.
Okay.
I don't remember who makes it. But it's not really an all-in-one unit. It's actually a shell that you snap the Wii Remote into.
Okay, that's a way to do it. Yeah.
And it retains the Wii Remote functionality,
mm-hmm.
because there's a Wii Remote in it, so it inherently would still have that functionality.
Right.
But, I can't remember what it's called, but in terms of look and feel, it feels okay, but it looks like shit. So you probably never think to try it.
Well, anyway, let's move on. Greg, you've got the next letter.
Spencer from Kansas writes, with Enslaved coming out this week, it really made me think if Nintendo would ever make a game with this type of platforming. Think Uncharted, Prince of Persia, etc. I would love to see their spin on it, and it could even be done in a cartoon fashion if they must, although it might have to be a new IP. Realistically, I can envision a Zelda game where you play as Zelda herself, crazy, right, doing acrobatic moves and such. Anyways, what are your thoughts, and do you think it's a possibility?
This is such a weird question, because the types of games that Spencer is talking about here, Uncharted, Prince of Persia, are in some ways derivative of games that Nintendo made a couple generations ago. You know, things like Mario Sunshine, Ocarina of Time, 3D platformers, 3D adventure games. I mean, they combine elements of these, and I think, you know, Nintendo certainly could go back to it. I think in some ways they are with things like, you know, Zelda Skyward Sword. With Mario Galaxy 2. I mean, they've continued maybe on their own independent path, but there is a shared ancestry between something like Galaxy 2 and Uncharted 2.
I think, the biggest sort of disparity between the two types that I observed, I've spoken about this before, in particular with regard to Assassin's Creed 2, is with the visual fidelity, the kind of observation element to it. that's a lot of, it's a lot of it is kind of having a detailed organic environment and decoding that into an obstacle course.
Right.
And they do little different things to highlight stuff. Like in Uncharted 2, there's a lot of like red colored scenery or just colorful scenery that'll tip you off that that's, you know, where you're supposed to go next and things. Just put little sort of details in there to help you kind
and
of.
And see, I never even noticed that, but that doesn't mean it wasn't effective when I played it.
Yeah, it perhaps works on a subconscious level. Yeah. I mean, it's guiding you to kind of find the platform design in what is meant to be this very convincing, realistic environment. But of course, that is dependent on the graphical fidelity being there to make that kind of environment. And of course, Nintendo has not really been about that lately, obviously, with the specs of the system. Right. And from an art design point of view, you know, we've seen that after what happened with Twilight Princess, you know, they're kind of reverting back to a more abstract art style for Skyward Sword, less detail, more watercolor kind of style. Mario's always going to be very colorful and bright and bold. And,
I hope so.
It's not going to hide, it's not going to hide the platform design, you know, it's always going to be right in your face. So I think those are the, when you talk about the shared ancestry, I think that's absolutely right. But in terms of the fork in the road, where they've kind of gone, what you've got is the kind of the action part of it in some of these HD games, at least the ones I've played. I haven't played like the cel-shaded Prince of Persia, for instance. But you know, there's a sort of level of automation that's going on in those games.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting debate on its own.
Whereas in Nintendo stuff is still more about you doing the actions.
So. See, Greg, I think I would counter your point with the Metroid series, which is more about conveying a sort of believable organic environment with, I'm still very much a platformer, but you have to figure out where can I go, where can I bomb, where are these tunnels? They're not always readily apparent. And they do it in, you know, but especially in the older 2D games, they do it in different ways. Than you can now on the HD consoles and 3D environment and everything. But I mean, even in Other M, there are places where there's like a secret passage and I really had to look at it because I looked over it the first time. It didn't stand out. They don't call your attention to it. And you have to kind of go back and really pay attention and observe and, you know, investigate this area and figure out where am I supposed to go here? Oh, there's a crack in the wall there. I didn't see it before.
So and they do that with, you know, with the camera, you know, in that as well. Yeah, they kind of, they're probably not so able to do it with the graphical fidelity, although it looks really good and that helps. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's with Other M, I think, in that regard.
There are other ways to do it other than just high definition. James, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I was trying to say earlier is that I would backpedal a little bit from the Skyward Sword discussion about it being very colorful and things, because the most recent screenshots show more detail and less color.
Yeah, so they did say it was a word. I heard about that.
Yeah, so they're on the site, and I was going to write a news article about that.
Oh, I haven't
but then,
seen them yet.
Because they said at E3 that the art style was kind of a work in progress. So
yeah, I mean, it's still colorful, but it's not nearly as pastelish as it was at E3. Hmm. But I'm not sure that that's really their game, if that makes sense. At risk of using that word again. I feel like they don't really want to be the follower in their genres that they go into. And if they were to make a game like Uncharted or Prince of Persia, they would be accused of making a clone of Uncharted and Prince of Persia. And I'm not sure they really want to get into that fray, because it's already a crowded enough field as it is. They want to do their own thing and do it as best they can.
It's just, I mean, like I said, to me, it just comes down to abstraction. You know, I mean, Nintendo is typically likes to work in those fields. Like you said, Metroid, in its sci-fi-ness, is kind of a weird halfway house because they do try and make an organic world, but it is also, you know, very fantastical.
I think you can give a certain amount of that to, it wasn't quite as fantastical when it first started as a series as it is now. I mean, it was, but I think at the time, the kinds of games that came out during the NES era, pre-NES era, maybe even into the SNES era, there was a much more emphasis on these sci-fi games because it was like leveraged on what movies did.
Yeah.
And I think now it's basically just Sakamoto gets to do whatever he wants, essentially. And he can push that game wherever he feels.
That's
like
pretty,
pushing it.
Pretty evident from Other M.
Yeah. No longer
it's You've hit the nail on the head there, James.
It's his and he can do with it as he pleases.
Well, at least he could up until now. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see if he's allowed to continue.
I think part of that, and it ties into Sakamoto's apparent ability to do whatever he wants, is that there's a very strong centralized culture of creation at Nintendo where there are a handful of people who basically make the creative calls in that company.
Mm-hmm.
It's Miyamoto, Sakamoto, to a lesser extent.
Anuma.
Although I still think he probably does have to go to Miyamoto when he does things.
Kono, Eguchi, I mean, you know, they're the producers, the Nintendo producers.
Right. And then I think pretty much everybody falls in line behind them.
Sure.
So we're probably going to see the games that they want to see made, and I don't think there's a big draw amongst them to make these heavily Western-styled games like Prince of Persia or Uncharted Genocide Edition.
I'm not interested in that. I would like to maybe see them be somewhat influenced by what the West does, because I think there's a give and a take that's very healthy. I mean, certainly these Western games, as I said before, they've benefited a lot from being influenced by Nintendo's work, as well as that of a lot of other Japanese companies. And I don't really see that going the other direction. And you're starting to see the consequences of that in the Japanese market, where there's a lot of creative stagnation because they're kind of feeding off of themselves. And they're not bringing, you know, they're not trading culturally with the games that are being made other places. But I think the other part of this is that maybe the main difference in what games like Prince of Persia, Assassin's Creed, Uncharted are doing with these third-person action-adventure games, which Nintendo has a strong history in, the main difference is that they're telling stories while you play the game.
Yeah.
And Nintendo really is not good at that, and they usually don't even try. I would argue that even with games like Twilight Princess and Other M, which have a lot of failures in storytelling, they're not really trying to tell the story while you play the game. They're still taking the very old-fashioned approach of telling it during special scenes, you know, during special moments.
Stop and talk.
Yes, stop and talk. And these other games are, this is a very strong motif in Western game development right now. They're telling the story while you play it. And they might still occasionally stop and show a scene, but that stuff you could almost skip. I mean, you're still going to get the gist of it. Prince of Persia, that cel-shaded Prince of Persia, is a perfect example. That entire story is told while you're in control.
With the handful of exceptions, yeah.
It's very effective, and I would love for Nintendo to sort of attempt that, because I'm struggling to think of an example where they've even have ever done anything like that.
That they haven't.
Super Metroid is the sort of the only thing I think of in terms of, you know, there are kind of cutscenes, but some of them are kind of interactive, like, you know, Ridley escaping at the start, or, you know,
okay.
But there's no dialogue in that.
You certainly don't have characters talking to each other while you play the game.
Story is a very loose statement for that game.
Right,
I mean,
right.
But there's some sort of cinematic kind of action going on.
Right. It's not a Nintendo game, although it is a Japanese game. It's an incredibly Japanese game. But Fragile Dreams has a lot of that, in that there's not even events that are taking place. It's just as you look around at things that are lying around, they're telling stories just by where they're placed and what their current condition is and the environment you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very environmentally driven story. There are cutscenes in there, but they're more or less, you could skip some of them.
But I suppose the key thing with the sort of where the narrative meets gameplay style is that, you know, in these games you've got settings which are meant to fit into the narrative, so they've got to be organic in every way. You know, this is a cathedral that you're, you know, jumping around in.
That's full of flying coffins with faces on them.
As, you know, Ezio in Assassin's Creed 2, which is, you know, in Italy, you know, and it all fits and it all fits together. And you then have to make some sort of game design platform challenge out of that. Whereas I just think it is not generally in Nintendo's nature to box themselves in that way.
Right, they make the game first and the story second.
As we said, the story is not their forte, it's not their sort of preference, and they would probably regard it as a sort of arbitrary constraint on their ability to make a compelling gameplay experience in most cases. So that's why this is somewhat unlikely. But still, I think you're right, I would like to see them synthesize some of the elements that are in these games into something that fits more into their own way of thinking. So not just getting little bits of it and dropping it into a sort of melange, but, you know, really putting some of those elements into a quintessentially Nintendo experience that is still all about the game.
Yeah, no one wants Nintendo to make an Uncharted clone. There's enough of those out there, enough companies sort of making an ass out of themselves from even trying to do that.
Uncharted itself, it's built on other games too.
Eco, as I've said before, I was built on a lot of things. Tomb Raider and Eco and Zelda and Gears of War.
Yeah, and some of those games share control mechanics with things like RE4.
Yes, absolutely. I guess it's maybe not so much a case of I want Nintendo to try some of these methods that other developers are doing. I'd like for Nintendo to try something new.
Anything new.
Especially with Zelda, you know, in terms of storytelling in particular. I don't care if they... I would love for them to do something no one else has ever done before. That would be refreshing. But what I don't want is for Skyward Sword to be full of me talking to characters who just look at me with weird looks on their faces while I read badly written text about what the story is supposed to mean to me, because when they do it that way, the story doesn't mean anything to me, and I'd rather they just didn't even try. If they're going to try, they should try something new, because what they've been doing before doesn't work.
Mm.
Wind Waker was a triumph of storytelling.
I'd say it was a half success. It was certainly better than Twilight Princess in terms of telling the story.
Well, I mean, by their standards, that was...
Yeah, it was a triumph for their standards,
yes,
yeah. But
sure.
I mean, look, it still got some of those problems, but I think visually, it was just so... It was very good as visual storytelling.
Mm-hmm. I think the way it succeeds by most people's standards is, A, it had a narrative that started, you know, it's not just the end of the world here. I mean, there was a jumping off point.
Yeah, it's a more personal quest.
Right, and it has a villain that isn't just a jackass who wants to rule the world. He has a characterization.
I see you remember that part better than I do. The whole Ganondorf part didn't resonate with me much.
It's just because he has some dialogue that's not like,
that's what I'm saying. By their standards,
in
it
relative
was a
terms, it is humanizing. In absolute terms,
not so much.
He's still not much of a character.
It's amusing because it's the most they've ever humanized him, and then they stab him in the forehead. So it's like,
yeah.
It's like, thanks a lot, game.
Yeah.
That was
the wind is blowing through my skull. Is the a bit that they didn't put onto the end there. I mean, for me, the most important aside, the thing with Zelda, the new Zelda, for me, is all about the structure, because they've talked about, you know, blurring the lines between the quote unquote field and the dungeons.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not so segmented, and it's just this sort of rhythmic jaunt around the field dungeon, fetch quest dungeon.
Right.
And
I completely agree. I would also like them to blur the line between the game and the story. That would be awfully sophisticated.
It's a similar sort of thing, because the story has become partitioned in pretty much the same way.
Right.
And it would be a more kind of organic experience, but unfortunately, just the kind of... The abstraction that Nintendo is generally given to often gives them these wonderfully unconstrained creative canvases to work on in gameplay terms, leads to these very partitioned and predictable elements in other areas of the game.
Well, what I thought was going to happen with Twilight Princess, especially with the teaser trailer they released initially,
yeah,
because, you know, that we can't show a Zelda game at enough E3's mentality that Nintendo has. That teaser trailer implied heavily that the game was going to spend, and they talked about it, the game was going to devote significant efforts to field combat, which they almost made it sound like there was going to be almost Dynasty Warriors style combat in the field.
Thankfully, there wasn't.
Well, no. I think if there were like real battles in the field versus like those two events you have, one on the bridge and then one outside the bridge.
The big horse battles. I mean, those are cool scenes, but you're right; they're not integral parts of the game.
If they wanted to blur the lines with the field and the dungeons, I feel like battles like that are how they would do it.
Yeah, that's what I find it fascinating, because obviously what we've seen of the new Zelda so far does not really lend any insight to how this will be done. But
no, all
that's
we saw
what
was
they've
a training
talked
area.
About, and you know, that is clearly to me, you know, something that needs to happen. I think to make it less of a procession, to make it less sadly predictable. But at the same time, it's not without risk in terms of maintaining, you know, some of that, perhaps the intricacy of the puzzles when they are there, or you know. Lots of challenges.
So if I can make one final comment before we move on, in order to have the sort of, not interactive, but to have some of the real-time storytelling, you know, story while you play the game that these Western-developed games have, I don't know how you can do that without having your main character participate in the conversation.
Mm, yeah.
And that is breaking the cardinal rule of Nintendo games. So at some point, if they want to go down that route, if they want to bring story and dialogue into the game itself and not just in the cutscenes, they're going to have their characters talk.
Because even in Other M, Samus barely participates in the conversations.
Right, all her stuff is narration, it's all flashback.
It's just recounted to you how she felt and all that. She's not...
Which is one of the main problems of the game.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what's going on
in
the story,
it's so detached and...
She is almost the silent protagonist, apart from just a few lines. You know, well, there's one particular scene I could think of that's there's a fair bit of back and forth. But you know, in general, again, yeah, they are just really bad about having the protagonist participate in conversations like a person.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So the last letter is from Andy S. in Columbus, Ohio, who writes, "I'm a longtime listener and first-time emailer. I recently pre-ordered Kirby's Epic Yarn because it looks gorgeous, creative, and just plain adorable. This will be my second Kirby game ever, the first being Kirby's Adventure on the Game Boy. And I wanted to hear about your favorite Kirby game so I can try one from the back catalog, as well as why you think this character has remained a staple for Nintendo. Favorite Kirby games, go."
Johnny really has nothing to say about this.
That's not true. I have an answer coming up. I just...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big Kirby fan, but Canvas Curse is definitely my choice because it's just a really compelling use of the DS touchscreen. Even now, all these 5 years later, has not really been matched, I don't think.
I agree.
It's well designed. You still got some of that Kirby absorbing powers kind of gameplay in there a little bit, although obviously it works quite differently, and it's certainly more challenging than your average Kirby game.
It is indeed.
Not particularly stiff-like, but it's still considerable, relatively. So if you haven't tracked down that yet, absolutely find it.
So I think the game he's talking about when he says it's his favorite is Dreamland, because that's the Game Boy game.
Yes, that's the last Kirby game he played.
Yeah, which would also be the first Kirby game.
Yes.
Kirby Adventure is the NES game, and that's actually the game that I was going to mention. And I really enjoyed that game a lot. It's got some weird little quirky side games in there. It's just a generally fun game. It's not hard. I mean, I beat it as a kid. With no effort whatsoever, and I used to play it.
It's not insultingly easy like Kirby's Dream Land on Game Boy, though.
I would play the entire game in a sitting, and then come back later and play it again. And I probably beat that game a dozen or more times, and I really enjoy it. And I think that it's on the Virtual Console for, what, 500 points? I mean, there's no reason not to go play it. It's really good. I also enjoy the SNES game.
Superstar or Dreamland 3?
Superstar.
Okay.
But I think Dreamland 3 is also a good game too, so.
James, I guess from your initial reaction after I've read the letter that you must think I don't like Kirby.
I think you've made that statement.
You may call it just the level design is
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have a very specific critique of Kirby. I don't like the level designs in a lot of the games, but I'll have you know I've played almost every Kirby game ever released and I like almost all of them. And Greg stole my answer. I think Canvas Curse is the one that you should play, even though it's not a typical Kirby game. If you played the Game Boy one, you've kind of already played the typical Kirby game.
That's not true, though, because the Game Boy one doesn't have the ability to absorb power.
That's true. I mean, in that case, James, you might have the best sort of archetypal selection there. And I actually bought Kirby's Adventure on Virtual Console, even though I'd already played it before, and I played all the way through it. I loved it.
Does it take very long?
No, it's like a 2 or 3 hour game. But I would say it depends a little on what you like. If you like sort of maybe a more straightforward action game, I would recommend Kirby 64, also on Virtual Console. And again, the level designs are not that great, but the way that you copy powers and you mix powers to get really strange new powers is really fun. And the game's not that challenging, but there are parts of it that are relatively difficult for a Kirby game.
I think the hardest part in that game is when you start mixing powers and you get screwed up in the middle of it.
It can happen. Yeah, you have to watch out. You don't want to willy-nilly copy powers because you can end up with some fairly useless combinations.
I turn into a block of ice now.
Yeah.
Thank you, game.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Superstar is good for variety, but I do think that game's a little overrated. I would actually recommend a relatively obscure Kirby game for GBA called Kirby and the Amazing Mirror.
The one that's like Metroid, everyone.
Yes, I was going to say, if you are a Metroid fan like I am, then that might be your best choice. It's quite short. You can beat it in a couple hours. But it's basically like a big Kirby-fied Metroid world, and you have to copy specific abilities to get to new areas, and it's all kind of open. It has some really cool co-op support that you'll probably never get to use anymore. But it's really well made. It's just a very, very, very well made Kirby game. It's up there near the top of my list.
From the makers of Oracle of Ages and Seasons and Minish Cap.
Yes.
Flagship. I suppose to the question of why has he sort of remained viable and popular and all, I think probably the main thing you've got to say is the flexibility of the character. You can pretty much do whatever you like with him. I mean, he's been just the little ball in Canvas Curse or, some of the spin-off games. You could do random crap with him for, like, Dream Course.
Right, turn him into a pinball.
The most recent example with Epic Yarn, I mean, there was the Iwata Asks was published just recently, where Goodfeel talked about the fact that, unsurprisingly in many ways, it didn't start as a Kirby game. I think the sidekick character, Prince Fluff or whatever, was just the character. And then Kirby was just inserted into it.
It got dinosaur planeted, basically.
Nice.
Because they felt, he could fit into it. And that's he can fit into a lot of things because he's just this amorphous pink blob.
The fact that Kirby itself was just a stand-in character so they could create something better pretty much is the root cause of its ability to be anything, essentially. I mean, because it really was. It was just a fill-in.
And I would also say that the game, James mentioned Kirby's Adventure, which is kind of Kirby 2, for lack of a better term.
It's like Kirby 1 also. It's like they're both Kirby 1.
It's really a total reset of that game. It plays very differently from Kirby's Dream Land, and primarily because of those copy abilities. Also, the level selection is also non-linear, which makes it feel different, and it has kind of this overworld. But the copy ability, which was introduced on the NES game, Kirby's Adventure, it saved that series, because I feel that, if they had just tried to make a straight sequel to Kirby's Dream Land that played pretty much the same way, that series wouldn't have lasted very long, because it's boring.
I mean, it was good when it came out, but beyond that, it's like, eh.
Yeah, I mean, it was a serviceable 2D platformer for Game Boy, but people had low expectations for that kind of thing back then.
I mean, in Dream Land 2, it's not Dream Land. It's closer to Adventure plus Animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is obviously Sakurai was trying to create, a platformer that was, where the bar was a lot lower than it was with most of the 8-bit stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the point that, in that earliest form, there really isn't a whole lot to it, I guess, from everything I've ever heard. Whereas at least when you bring in the copy ability stuff, even if the level design or the enemy design doesn't really make it essential to make like really creative or efficient use
of... But you've almost made a sandbox for the player, and you can make your own fun even if the game doesn't challenge you much. And that's...
Exactly. There's some sort of ability to express yourself, mm-hmm. and experiment and have fun in different ways in the context of a game where just going from A to B is not really much of an impediment.
Right.
Right. Kirby Dream Land 2 plus cats. Yes.
I'll tell you, you can put him in anything.
It's a hamster, a fish, and an owl, I think, is Kirby Dream Land 2, but okay. I think we need to add cats, too. It also repurposed a lot of art assets from Mario games on the Game Boy, which is interesting.
Maybe I'll get to try that on the virtual handheld. So there we go. You can kind of maybe, based on our descriptions, you can figure out which one of those sounds most appealing to you. But there's a lot of choices with Kirby. Most of the Kirby games are good. Stay away from Squeak Squad, and you'll probably be okay.
but somebody needs to get his cake back.
Mm. All right. Thank you so much to everyone who wrote in. We had some really fun emails this week. The address, if you haven't had a letter read yet or not lately, you should really write in, because we love hearing from people who haven't been heard before or who haven't written in for a while. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Next week, we have Retroactive. Yoshi's Story is going to be the game du jour.
Go eat some fruits.
Yeah, go eat some fruit, get prepared. If you haven't played the game ever before, this is a perfect opportunity. It's $10 on Virtual Console. Check it out, just like we are. There's a forum thread. You can find a link in the article to this story, or just hit up the forums, go to podcast discussion. You'll see it there. And we've had some really, really interesting posts in that forum thread. I'm looking forward to bringing those up using those as a launching pad for the discussion. And it's a very interesting game. I think it's worth your time to check it out if you never have before. So that's going to be next week. And finally...
So the live radio trivia was delayed a week. So it will be next week. The 15th, I believe, of October.
Okay. 15th of October.
Yeah. Apologize for that. Apparently it was delayed and I'd missed that memo.
Well, the good news is you haven't missed it. If you're listening to this
that's right.
Within a few days of when it's posted, then you still have a chance to go to the encore presentation of Live Radio Trivia with James and Carly, and you definitely should do that.
Consult the article on the site for more details.
There you go.
Which should be up soon.
All right. With that, we're going to end the show. Thanks very much for listening, for writing in. Check us out on Facebook, iTunes, the website, TalkBack. It's all there. We'll see you next week. I like Layton, but I don't need just more puzzles. I need, you know, I want it to play a little differently. I want it to bring something new to the table. So either with the RPG and the fourth one or the 3D puzzles and stuff like that in the fifth one for 3DS.
We before we get into too deep, we were discussing the ramifications.
Too deep.
Yeah, I know. We were discussing the ramifications
Cue the
of
Phil Collins.
Level 5. Level 5 self-publishing.
Oh, God.
Oh, jeez.
Now you're thinking about American Troika.
All right. Well, the next email is from Leroy Pantweather.
Leroy?
I don't think that's his real name. From Glendale, Arizona. He did mention something about the Patriots, and I wonder if the only reason he's a Patriots fan is because he lives in Glendale and he sees them come through every couple years.
Hey, look, let's just Patriots business. Let's just if you're when I was a kid 20 years ago, the Patriots were awful.
They were dreadful.
Absolutely
yes.
Abysmal. This is back in the Victor Kiam. I like the team so much I bought
this
it.
This isn't getting
days.
Cut, by the way. This is all staying in.
And if you're a fan of the Patriots from back then, I have no quarrel with you. You went through the tough times. And now they're good, and they've won 3 Super Bowls in 4 years at one point, and that's fine. But if, on the other hand, you've picked the Patriots because you think, oh, here's a team with a coach who's an unrepentant cheat. And here's a team with a quarterback who gets to trade up from Bridget Moynihan to Giselle Bundchen and then let her style his hair for him and for photo shoots with farm animals.
Then
we have a quarrel, sir. You and I are enemies forever.